Good Tuesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad to be coming to you today from Farmville, Virginia. Have a fantastic program for you. Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner will join us. Says there's plenty of precedent for rejecting Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, whoever that might be. Yes, you're going to see months of headlines complaining about the obstructionists in the Senate. But here's the thing, you know, if the Washington Post and Slate and the rest of the Times Square, Beltway-based media weren't complaining about that, they'd be complaining about something else, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they? I don't think, well, the press will go easy on us is a very good reason to say, well, okay, we're going to go ahead and just let that appointment go through. Because the press isn't going to take it easy on Republicans in the Senate or in the House for any reason between now and Election Day. I just don't think that's particularly likely. Anyway, we'll talk with Michael Barone about it later on in the hour. From the Great American Outdoor Show, Pat Rogers with SWAT Magazine. He was holding and conducting seminars on understanding the AR platform. It's a fascinating conversation. Here's a guy who's, you know, former law enforcement, former military. Very first question I asked him was, so you really think that, you know, civilians should be able to own these firearms? You have to stay tuned for Pat's answer. Next hour, Alicia Ketter, firearms instructor with Legacy Defense Systems on the Every Town and Cosmopolitan magazine, teaming up for their singled out section, I Am a Gunsplainer. Yeah. Every Town tweeting out my gunsplanation, I guess, about why it's important to think about self-defense. Now, they took this quote, didn't provide any context for it, accused me of victim blaming. The quote was something like, if you're the victim of a violent attack, it's not up to your attacker to stop that attack, because they won't. It's up to you. The burden at that point in time is on the victim. It's on the victim. This was in response to an editorial from the University of North Carolina student newspaper objecting to campus carry, in which the author said that if you had campus carry, that it would, quote, further burden the victim with their own defense. Now, I don't know how you could further burden somebody. It seems to be like either the burden of self-defense or burden of defense of yourself is either on you or it's not. I don't think I don't think about that in terms of percentages. Do you? Well, you know, you're 30% responsible for your own safety, but 70% not. No, at that moment in time, when you're the victim of an attack, whether it is a sexual assault, a home invasion, a carjacking, where is that burden of your safety placed? Again, perhaps unwanted responsibility, reluctantly accepted, that burden. Where does it lie? Does it lie with the person who's actually attacking you? That they'll be stricken with pangs of conscience? What am I doing? What am I doing with my life? What am I doing to this person right here across from me? This is a human being, for God's sakes. I should just turn around and walk away. How often does that happen? Believe me, I wish it happened a lot more. But it doesn't seem to happen that frequently. Does the burden of your safety lie on law enforcement in your community? Well, the police will be here soon enough if somebody has called 911, and they'll put a stop to this crime. If you think that's the case, ask a police officer how likely it is that they will be able to roll up and respond in time to prevent a crime from occurring. Ask them. They're going to tell you it's not likely. They're going to tell you, unless they're a politically appointed police chief, they're likely to tell you that they would like you to be able to protect yourself. And they recognize it's not always going to be possible in every instance. But they would like you to have that opportunity. They'd like you to have that chance. I have to say, it is, it's kind of bizarre to me that they even picked out this quote as trying to portray this as victim blaming. But we'll talk about it with Alicia Ketter, again, from Legacy Defense Systems. She is a firearms instructor. We talked with her up in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Teaches a lot of women about self-defense. And frankly, by the way, that quote didn't use the word gun. I didn't say the word gun. Certainly never said the word blame, because it wasn't about victim blaming. It was about empowering people to think about self-defense, right? And in that moment, if you are unlucky enough to be the victim of a violent crime, being able to, hopefully, protect yourself. Because you can't leave it up to the criminal to have a change of heart. And you can't leave it up to law enforcement to be lucky enough to be close by and stop that attack. But if this is, you know, it's interesting. If this is the best argument that every town has, take this quote, try to turn it into some sort of statement of blame the victim. Again, doesn't it say a lot about how good or bad their arguments really are? Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum will join us in Hour 2 as well with a nanny state update. In Hour 3, Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto. It was Grammys night last night. I don't believe Toto won any Grammys. I'm not even sure they were invited. Kendrick Lamar winning a Grammy, and Barack Obama tweeting out congratulations to Kendrick Lamar. Which is interesting because Victor Davis Hanson, not long ago, a couple of weeks ago, had a an essay in which he talked about President Obama's support for Kendrick Lamar. Said he was recently said that Kendrick Lamar's album is a favorite of the year. Victor Davis Hanson talked about the cover of that album, the theme of that album. President Obama, sorry, said that, President Obama said that Lamar said How Much a Dollar Cost was his favorite song of 2015. Not the favorite album. Album is called To Pimp a Butterfly. Victor Davis Hanson says the album cover shows a crowd of young African-American men massed in front of the White House. In celebratory fashion, all are gripping champagne bottles and $100 bills. In front of them lies the corpse of a white judge with two X's drawn over his closed eyes. Huh. Well, that's interesting. Again, we'll talk about the cultural impact that President Obama might have here with the Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto, and really the cultural impact of Hollywood, because, again, Hollywood can't make up its mind whether or not they are artists whose work, be it in the medium of movies or television or music, whether or not those are pieces of art that are supposed to move us, that are supposed to have an impact on us emotionally, or whether they're just simple, crass entertainers and they're not to be taken seriously, and there's no way that their music or movies or television could have any sort of impact on us in terms of, you know, violence or the negative messages that it might send. They can't make up their mind. If the result is good and beneficial, right, if it makes us feel warm and fuzzy, we get out there and we try to save the environment, aha, yes, this is an example of art. But if, on the other hand, the message that is being sent is, again, one of wanton violence, disrespect towards women or other human beings, then no. This is just, it's not art, it's just entertainment, right? I don't really think you can have it both ways. Either accept that you're simple entertainers, you're the court jesters of our culture, and, you know, we shouldn't pay any more attention to you than anybody else. Doesn't mean that your opinion is automatically invalid. Just means that, you know, you're no smarter than anybody else. Or accept that you are artistes. And then maybe you start to think about the messages that your fellow artistes are putting out there. Bethany Boer, a conservative activist, will join us on the program in Hour 3. Also, John Cardillo's new intern, I found out yesterday. John was nice enough to have me on his program, and John said that Bethany is interning for him now on his radio show. It's a small world, after all. Plus, we have the hero of the day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, the deal of the day, and the good guy of the day. But let's start our coverage today of the Second Amendment stories around the world by talking about Jesse Hughes, the lead singer of the band Eagles of Death Metal. They were on stage at the Bataclan Theater when it was attacked by those in support and solidarity with ISIS in Paris last year. 89 people were murdered that night in the Bataclan Theater. And Eagles of Death Metal vowed that they would come back and perform in Paris again. And they did. They opened up for U2 recently. But they were also back in Paris performing at Olympia Hall tonight. And Jesse Hughes, the frontman for Eagles of Death Metal, giving some interviews to French television. We've got a clip of Jesse Hughes when he was asked about gun control. Now, he was asked about this. Jesse Hughes is a gun owner. Apparently, he's an NRA member. That's what he says. And he is a guy for whom surviving this attack has not changed his mind, hasn't turned him into a staunch gun control advocate. Take a look at Jesse Hughes talking to French media there about that attack in the Bataclan Theater and the right to carry a firearm.
I haven't had any nightmares, and I've slept fine, but when I'm awake is when I see things that are nightmares, you know? And I thought that talking about it would make it easier, and I thought that expelling it from inside of me would make me less like this, but it's not. There's really no frame of reference for this at all. I just wish it would go away. Gun control kind of doesn't have anything to do with it, but if you want to bring it up, I'll ask you, did your French gun control stop a single person from dying at the Bataclan? And if anyone can answer yes, I'd like to hear it, because I don't think so. I think the only thing that stopped it was some of the bravest men that I've ever seen in my life charging headfirst into the face of death with their firearms. Maybe, I know people will disagree with me, but it just seems like God made men and women, and that night guns made them equal. And I hate it that it's that way. I think the only way my mind has been changed is maybe that until nobody has guns, everybody has to have them. Because I don't ever want to see anything like this ever happen again. And I want everyone to have the best chance to live. And I saw people die that maybe could have lived. I don't know. But I wish I knew for sure if they could have had a better chance. Because there were some real angels, real wonderful people at that show that are alive today. And I really wish they were.
For Jesse Hughes. This isn't something that he debates online. Here is a man who saw with his own eyes the absolute depravity, a massacre committed by individuals who weren't interested in anything other than causing death and destruction in as much of it as possible. There is no way that you can listen or watch Jesse Hughes and think that what he said was some sort of parroting of the gun lobby or anything other than his deeply held sincere belief that he doesn't want to see anybody go through that again. NBC News describes this as says Hughes, who has vigorously advocated for unfettered gun ownership, even waving a gun at a friend in a documentary that was pulled from film festivals after the November 13th attacks, told iTelly that if anything, his experience had only strengthened his views. He also said, you have to stay light. He said, you have to keep your heart light. He said, I'm not going to let the bad guys win. Kudos, I suppose, to NBC and other media for covering what Jesse Hughes had to say. But, you know, it's interesting. This NBC News story, not everybody's going to click the link and hear that video or watch that video, right? A lot of people just kind of skim the story. Here's how NBC News reported. In an interview Monday with the Friends television station iTele, Hughes, a longtime gun rights activist, maintained not only that fringe gun restrictions didn't inhibit the terrorists, but they actually made it easier for them. And then there's a quote. Hughes, who has vigorously advocated for unfettered gun ownership, they don't describe his emotions at all. There's no phrase like in an emotional interview with iTele. Right? You actually have to watch, you have to click that link, you have to watch that video, you have to hear Jesse Hughes, who is still clearly not gotten over that. How do you get over something like that? Give a very emotional response when asked about gun control. They just made it seem like, you know, he was up on his soapbox. I wonder if Everytown or Cosmopolitan will accuse him next of being a gunsplainer. All right, we're going to take a quick time out. When we come back after the break, Michael Barone of the Washington Examiner says there is plenty of precedent for rejecting Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, no matter who that nominee might be. Stick around. We are just getting started here on this Tuesday edition of NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh,
so
I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed and Heels all about?
So Armed and Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed and Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried, you were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried, and then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. It seems you have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed and Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed and Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Speaking with Shade McMillan with H&M Black Nitride, welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So tell us, what is H&M Black Nitride? What's it all about?
We are, as opposed to all the different finishes that are out here in coatings, we are a heat treat business. And we service all the major OEMs and single gun customers at the SHOT Show.
How does it work?
It basically is a heat treat process that turns the parts black, adds corrosion protection, and it's a very slick and hard surface.
So it's I imagine that something, besides having a look to it, it's also great protective.
Yes. Very hard, very durable. The corrosion is extremely, there's nothing that can beat it.
Nothing
basically.
That can, and, no. and you guys are working with a lot of guys who would probably can attest to that. You got Bruce Pyatt, Tony Holmes, Doug Koenig, all signed on as sponsors.
Yes.
And so why are they using it? You tell me why a shooter would want to use this.
When you have your gun and you're all on the range and in the elements and you're competing, then you can't always take care of your weapon. It's a tool. Okay, it's not all meant to be pretty. What we do is provide that corrosion protection, that wear protection, that makes sure that they feel confident that their gear is always going to work.
It's H&M Black Nitride. I imagine, Shay, this has got, like, implications not only with shooting, with the military, with
yes.
law enforcement.
Yeah, we do a lot of aerospace work, locomotive. We have stuff in outer space for NASA we do.
Wow, that's cool. And you guys are also working over with your shooters here, but also with NRA over at Bianchi Cup as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, Bianchi Cup. My brother and I have been competing out there for 3 years. This will be our fourth year.
Cool.
We were the barbecue sponsor last year for the Bianchi Cup. And it's a great competition, very family-like, and we're a family-owned business, so we like that.
Awesome. How are we getting more information about H&M Black Nitride?
www.blacknitride.com.
Shay, thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA hey. News.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Still to come on the program this hour, thinking back to the Great American Outdoor Show, talk with Pat Rogers of SWAT Magazine. But right now, I want to welcome to the show from the Washington Examiner, Michael Barone is with us. Michael, how are you today?
I'm very well, sir.
Excellent. I appreciate you coming on the program. Your latest piece of the Washington Examiner, there's precedent for rejecting Obama's Supreme Court nominee. Now, listen, Michael, I have to say, you know, if you look at the pages of the Washington Post, I'm looking at a story or an op-ed from Philly.com right now, racist anti-Obama sentiment in Supreme Court imbroglio could backfire. Most of the, I think, left-leaning media right now is very, very interested in putting out this narrative that, no, this is wrong, this is improper, this is racist, this is horrible if the GOP were to not only give hearings to Barack Obama's Supreme Court nominee, whoever that might be, but if they failed to appoint that individual to the Supreme Court, then they're the worst people in the world.
Well, you know, Samuel Johnson said patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. Accusations of racism against somebody who opposes a policy of Barack Obama is a close by refuge, I think, for that category of people. Look, there's a history on this. We've had 160 Supreme Court nominations since the first president, George Washington. 36 of those have been rejected. 25 of those were rejected without a vote on the floor of the Senate. The Constitution definitely gives the president right to nominate Supreme Court justices. It gives the Senate the right to confirm or reject them. So the fact is that, you go back to 2007 and you had a Republican president and a Democratic majority Senate. You had Senator Charles Schumer, who's set to become the Democratic leader of the Senate in the next Congress, saying that 18 months prior to the inauguration of the next president, Democrats in the Senate should not approve any George Bush the judicial nominee. The fact is that he took that position at that time. Now he says things are different. Well, they are. You've got a president of his party and a Senate with a majority of the other party. But the fact is he was right then in the sense that the Senate is constitutionally entitled to reject the nominee.
And it seems to me that that's really pretty clear if you read the Constitution, if you understand the rule of law, and yet we have these arguments being made that even if constitutionally that's appropriate or that's allowed, Michael, it's still just wrong on some level. Is this just typical politics as usual? We should just anticipate that the party that's out of power is going to use every opportunity they can to become the party in power?
Well, I think we are seeing politics as usual, and that's because the Supreme Court decisions have affected issues which are political issues, which are very important to people on both sides of the issue. You can take the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage, for example. Although the Obama appointee replacing Justice Scalia would not change the outcome of those decisions. And you can look at the Heller versus D.C. case of 2008, in which Justice Scalia wrote the opinion for a 5-4 majority, recognizing that the Second Amendment conveys a personal right, guarantees a personal right to keep and bear arms. that decision is likely to go the other way, as the Chief Justice Ginsburg has predicted, if an Obama nominee takes a seat on the court.
So Michael, do you have any predictions or any thoughts on how this process might play out? I mean, the president has said that he'll nominate somebody. And honestly, the list of names, to me, I've seen some what I think are some pretty crazy suggestions, including Eric Holder, the current Attorney General Loretta Lynch. You know, do you think that this will play out, that the president makes his nomination and then it simply folds? Is there a lot of political pressure or cultural pressure being brought on Republicans to change their mind? And how do you wrangle 100 cats to or 54 cats, I suppose, at this point?
Well, if the Republicans, you know, are in a mood to obey New York Times editorials, they will confirm President Obama's choice. I don't think that's going to happen. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell basically said it's not. The nomination can simply go to the Judiciary Committee, and no action could be taken. The Judiciary Committee has the majority of votes to vote against it, in my judgment. If it comes to Senator McConnell is not obliged to bring a nomination, certainly if it's rejected by the committee, even if it's accepted to the floor of the Senate. And on the floor of the Senate, there are 54 Republican votes and 46 Democratic votes. And I've seen no indication that more than one Republican senator is even thinking of confirming an Obama appointee. So I think the answer is that President Obama's appointee will not be accepted. I think that the Democrats are hoping that they can tell a vivid life story of the nominee and portray the Republicans as rejecting somebody who is Hispanic or who is female or has some other characteristic that they think many voters will identify with. I think Republicans can defeat that fairly easily by simply not holding hearings on the nominee. There were no hearings on the nominees for more than a century of the Republic. The first one was held in 1916, that Louis Brandeis was nominated. Other nominees since then have been confirmed without hearings. There's no constitutional requirement or Senate rule requirement that the nominee be given a hearing.
Talking again with Michael Barone, columnist of the Washington Examiner, the Dean of American Politics. Yes. And Michael, listen, I appreciate your insight and your analysis, and I look forward to having you on again very, very soon, sir.
Okie doke. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. Michael Barone joined us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. You know, as we're talking with Michael about the politics, again, of the death of Antonin Scalia, and admittedly, there's no way to get around the politics, but on social media, the night that Antonin Scalia died, or at least the news broke that Antonin Scalia had passed away, things got really ugly really quickly. There's a piece at Bloomberg View, believe it or not, by law professor Stephen Carter, Yale University. And he writes about this. He said, when the news broke Saturday that Justice Antonin Scalia had died at the age of 79, my Twitter feed began to fill with hate. Not disagreement or disrespect, actual hate. He was an ignorant waste of flesh, wrote one young fool. His death was the best news in decades, cheered another. And then there was the woman who just had to tell the world that she felt safer now than she had at the death of Osama bin Laden. And several people expressed the hope, Stephen Carter writes, that Clarence Thomas would die next. Again, in the minutes after the news broke, this was the first reaction that a lot of people had. And they had no qualms about sharing that fervently held belief of, good, I'm glad he's dead, with the rest of the world. Professor Carter says, thus we see the discursive toll of our depressing Supreme Court death watch. We're actually rooting for people to die. He said, none of this is entirely new. He said, my mentor, Justice Thurgood Marshall, didn't die in harness, but I remember the death watch all the same. I was serving as one of his law clerks in 1980, the year Ronald Reagan was elected, and on election night, one of the television networks reported that Marshall had decided to quit the court in order to give Jimmy Carter the opportunity to make an appointment. Carter says the report was false, of course, and Marshall was furious. Some of the buildings speculated that the story had been planted by activists hoping that he would get the message and depart, clearing the way for a younger liberal voice, much as in recent years some on the left have openly, if cruelly, urged Ruth Bader Ginsburg to step down as though she owes them some special fealty. Throughout the Reagan administration, movement conservatives kept their envious eyes on Marshall's precarious health. After George H.W. Bush was elected in 1988, one silly activist, Carter says, went so far as to tell a reporter that he hoped Marshall was keeping the seat warm for Thomas. Disgusting. Carter says, but here's the thing. When Marshall, his health broken, at last stepped down in 1991 with a year and a half to live, there were only encomiums, even from conservatives. True, he says, Twitter didn't exist. If it had, perhaps the gleeful right would have been dancing in public and said whatever champagne was drunk was poured in private. And that makes all the difference, he says. To mute those cheers shows respect not only for the dead, but also for the institution. Dana Milbank over the Washington Post has a story titled The Ugly Political Spectacle Around Justice Scalia's Death. Now, Dana Milbank doesn't talk about what Professor Stephen Carter talks about. He doesn't even acknowledge that ugly spectacle. Instead, Dana Milbank focuses all of his attention on the quote, ugly spectacle of, quote, the conservative Twitterverse erupting with demands that the Senate refuse to confirm anybody nominated by President Obama to replace Scalia. That, he says, was the ugly political spectacle. Not people cheering the death of Antonin Scalia. Not the people who were hoping telling the world who they thought should die next. Nope. And by the way, I'm pretty sure Dana Milbank was aware of this. I'm pretty sure he saw a lot of the same tweets that Professor Stephen Carter saw. I just think it's more important to Dana Milbank anyway to try to talk about the ugly political spectacle of the conservative Twitterverse demanding that the Senate hold firm and refuse to confirm anybody nominated by President Obama. At the Washington Post, Dana Milbank says, McConnell in a statement said the American people should have a voice in the selection of their next Supreme Court justice. Milbank says, but the people have already had their say. They re-elected President Obama in 2012, and they elected a Republican majority to the Senate in 2014. That majority has every right to reject Obama's nominee, but McConnell and his colleagues appear to be asserting that they won't even consider a nominee. No hearings and no vote. That's a grim commentary, Milbank says, on the current state of dysfunction in American government. Now, again, compare that. So we already know that Milbank thinks, you know, forget the people who were cheering on the death of Antonin Scalia, right? That's not an ugly political spectacle. The real ugly political spectacle is this notion that, again, the Senate shouldn't confirm Barack Obama's nomination to the Supreme Court. Well, again, we learned from Michael Barone that it's actually not uncommon for the Senate to not have confirmed a Supreme Court justice. He said, and I think he was using Adam White's research at the Weekly Standard. The Senate has confirmed only 124 of 160 presidential Supreme Court nominations. And of the 36 unsuccessful nominees, fully 25 of them received no up or down vote. So is this a grim commentary on the current state of dysfunction in American government? Or is this something that has happened, what, more than two dozen times in our nation's history? There's been a lot of ugly political spectacles, including political reporters averting their eyes to some of the ugliest spectacles in order to focus their attention on their political opponents. When we come back after a quick timeout, we're going to head over to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Pat Rogers with the SWAT magazine was one of the many individuals there at the Great American Outdoor Show holding seminars. You know, that was a huge part of the Great American Outdoor Show. You had hundreds of seminars taking place over the 9 days, everything from game calling to self-defense. Pat was doing a seminar on understanding AR-15s. And we had the opportunity to speak with Pat over the weekend. We'll share that interview with you coming up right after this quick timeout here on NRA News, Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.
I'm speaking with Mark Gilardi with Shoot for a Cure. Mark, thanks for being on NRA News.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you having me here.
Tell us, what is Shoot for a Cure all about?
Shoot for a Cure, we're a national nonprofit. This is our 14th year. We go all over the country. We raise money for folks with leukemia, people with MS, and various other charitable causes. And since we've started, we've introduced over 1,600 people, new people, to the shooting sports, to sporting clay shooting, and we've raised $2.9 million net.
Wow.
For leukemia research, MS research.
So how did this all start?
On a dare. We were pheasant hunting, and somebody was commiserating about all the stupid golf tournaments we have to do, and da-da-da, and somebody says, well, we should do a pheasant hunt for charity. I said, nah, if you do a pheasant hunt, you're not going to get anybody. I said, but if you did a sporting clay shoot, you'd get people to come. And it was like everybody just stopped. And they looked at each other and they went, okay, do it.
Do we have an aha moment?
Yeah.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay. And so we did the first year, and we had, I think, 70 shooters. We raised 12 grand. And we did that for a couple of years. And then people started calling. Hey, can you bring that event up to Spokane? Can you bring that event to Southern Cal? Because we're out in Northern California. So, okay, we can do it. So then we had to figure out how to do the road show. Okay, what do we need? We need guns. We need sponsors. We need a trailer. We need a staff. So I talked to people in the industry that I knew. We all became certified instructors. We got a trailer. I came to my first SHOT Show, met Scott and met Carlo. And
how many years ago was that?
That was 14 years.
Oh, man.
So, and it was amazing the response we've gotten. And now we started with one event in Northern Cal. This year coming, we're going to have 17 events coast to coast. My program goal is $650,000. By the way, I forgot to tell you, last year was our record. When I first started this, I said to my buddy, I said, wouldn't it be nice if we could shoot all over the country and raise $500,000 for kids with cancer? And he says, yeah, that'd be nice. Well, guess what? We did it last year. $516,000 net we're sending to those charities. And we had 1,530 shooters at our events.
Wow.
It's awesome. And every year at some point in this show, I will cry. Because I'm just a big softie.
Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, you've got, and I love it, you have passion, you have enthusiasm. What? And you've been doing this for 14 years.
Yeah.
What keeps that fire alive in you to do this?
A couple of things. I met some patient heroes a couple of years ago. And when you see the kids and they're standing there and you know the little girl's got a wig on. She's been through hell. I can say hell, can't I?
Yeah.
Been through hell and she still manages a smile on her face. And I've got two daughters. And you just go home and hug your kids, and you thank God. And then it's like, I can help. We can do something to help. 2 years ago, leukemia came out with a new form of research. They took the HIV, the AIDS virus, and they took the stinger out of it, you know, the stuff that makes us sick.
Right.
And they retrained those T cells to, instead of attacking healthy cells, they're attacking cancer cells. And there's a video on our website called Fire with Fire. Leukemia Senate said, put this on your website. I cry every time I watch it. This girl was 2 weeks from dead. She was blue. They've tried everything. Just as a last-ditch effort, they did this, and they almost lost her. And 48 hours later, the color came back to her body. And it was like 6 years ago. 8 years, like now, she's living a normal, healthy life. And now, because of what they did with that virus, it's transforming into, it's going to change bone cancer, it's going to change breast cancer, it's the beginning of the end.
Yeah. And Mark, and all that on top of that, you're introducing people, instead of going to a golf tournament,
right,
into the shooting sports and kindling or rekindling our love for that as well.
Absolutely. You know how many people we see, they're like, they come out and they go, you know, I haven't shot this gun since I was 10 years older. This is my grandpa's 870.
Yeah.
And you get it and it's like, so I have an armorer, Remington gives me parts. We send it to the armorer. They clean it up. They put new seals in it, new piston. The guy goes out, and he's happy. He's having that experience that he last had when he was 10 years old, and we're giving it to him. And we're raising money for kids, you know.
Mark, how can people get more information about Shoot for a Cure?
Go to the website, shootforacure.us.
Thank you so much for being a part of this edition of NRA News. Cam and Company, still to come on the program. Alicia Ketter from Legacy Defense Systems. Julie Gunlock in studio from the Independent Women's Forum. Now, there's some Toto for you. Even though they weren't on the Grammys. And we will have more Toto, because Christian Toto is going to join us in the Hour 3 from Hollywood in Toto. Right now, though, I want to take you back to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and the Great American Outdoor Show, where we had the opportunity to spend some time with Pat Rogers from SWAT Magazine, a former law enforcement SWAT instructor, a former Marine, and a guy who was putting on seminars about the AR platform throughout the week there at the Great American Outdoor Show. Fascinating conversation. Take a look and a listen. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and very pleased to have with us on the program right now, training editor for SWAT Magazine, former New York police officer, a retired U.S. Marine Corps Chief Warrant Officer, Pat Rogers is with us. Pat, how are you, sir?
Doing great, sir. Thank you.
All right, absolutely. I appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule here in Harrisburg to spend a few minutes with us. Now, you are hosting a seminar, and you've been doing this throughout the Great American Outdoor Show. What exactly are you talking about here?
What we're trying to do is introduce average people, average Earth people, to the AR-15 platform to try and get rid of the demonization of the gun, make people understand that this is truly a functional gun.
All right, so let's start with this, because, as you say, there is a lot of demonization of this rifle that goes on here. You hear anti-gun activists calling it a modern battlefield weapon of war. You hear people saying that this is incredibly powerful, that it's much more powerful than a bolt-action firearm or your traditional hunting rifle. Why do you need this gun for anything other than committing mass murder? And here we have a former police officer, again, retired Chief Warrant Officer with the U.S. Marine Corps, and you're telling me that you don't have a problem with civilians, people like me, owning an AR platform rifle.
Actually, not having a problem doesn't even come close to it. I think that every American citizen should have one for a lot of reasons. One, it's a very functional gun. It's useful across the broad spectrum. We can hunt with it. We can shoot competitively with it. We can defend our life, our family, our country with it. It's an ergonomic gun. It's probably the best-known gun in the United States. Certainly, it's an iconic gun. Why wouldn't we have it? Why wouldn't we have something that's functional, more functional, in the hands of every good American citizen?
You know, when people object to the AR-15 and they talk about, well, it's not like, you know, the traditional wooden hunting rifle, I always think about how much the way we listen to music has changed since the AR platform was introduced. Right back then, you were listening maybe on a 45 to a single, maybe an LP, AM radio, right? But since then, we've had FM radio, cassettes, 8-track CDs. Now we're getting our music digitally.
Yeah.
We're still listening to music, right? The same thing, I think, holds true when we're talking about the AR platform. It is still functionally no different than any other firearm out there, but we have seen advances in terms of the material that we're making these guns out of. So it's lighter, it's more rugged, it's more durable, and it's a safer firearm.
Much safer. It's much more ergonomic. The ergonomics certainly a big thing for us, because once we can handle the gun correctly, we can handle the gun more safely and more efficiently. And I think the music is an absolute tremendous analogy. The music is music, but it's changed, and so has guns, so has cars, so has everything else.
Absolutely. So who is showing up for your seminars here in Harrisburg?
It's kind of interesting. The majority of the people that are coming have ARs, but about a third of them don't. Never touched an AR, haven't seen an AR before, but they're interested in it. And this sort of dovetails right into the students that I get at my classes. About two-thirds of my students are civilians, average Joes, no military, no police experience. They want to come out and they want to learn. And of that two-thirds, probably 10% of them have never handled an AR-15 before.
Really?
Yeah.
And is there a steep learning curve with handling an AR for the first time if you've had previous experience with firearms, or is it an easy gun to adapt to?
Very easy gun to adapt to, and again, it goes to the ergonomics. It's a simple gun to manipulate. The mechanical safety is in an easy place for either right-handed or wrong-handed shooters. Everything about the gun is functional.
So, I like how you just called me a wrong-handed shooter, by the way. I'm one of those lefties.
You can't sue me for libel.
But you're right. In fact, this is one of the things that, so we're, I have an ADCOR defense AR-style rifle, and one of the things that I like about this is that it's got an adjustable stock. It has an adjustable forward charging handle that's ambidextrous. I can swap it out left-handed, right-handed about 30 seconds. I'm left-handed. My wife is right-handed. But we can share this rifle,
yeah.
Right? And we can adjust the stock so it fits her better. It fits me better. It's a personalized platform.
Without a doubt. And the adjustable stock is always an interesting thing. Understanding that the politicians, it drives them crazy that the stock is adjustable. And I don't understand why. You adjust the seat of your car to make it easier for you to drive. Why can't we adjust the rifle for the same reason?
Yeah, well, I'm guessing this is – there's probably a lot of stuff that drives you crazy when you hear people say, if it's got these – it's got a bayonet lug, right? Or it's got a grenade launcher mount, Pat. Why do you need that?
It beats me. How many homicides have been completed with bayonets or grenade launchers? And the answer is none. You know, it's just an addition on the rifle. It means nothing except in the minds of the people that are trying to take it away from us. I'll never understand it.
Well, listen, I'm glad that you understand the AR, and I'm glad that you're offering these seminars here at the Great American Outdoor Show. And you said you do teach classes throughout the year. Where are you based out of, Pat?
I live in Northern Virginia, but I am a traveler, so I travel pretty much throughout the eastern United States, as far west as the Mississippi. I do all my traveling by vehicle, so I don't like traveling more than 2 or 3 days. But my company, EAG, has been in business for 25 years. We're obviously successful at what we do, and almost every class we do is an open enrollment class, so we want civilians to come into the class. We take, we're very fortunate in that we get a lot of mothers and sons, mothers and daughters, fathers and sons, husbands and wives come to the class. That makes me feel very, very good. It makes me feel good for what America hopefully will continue to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Pat, listen, it has been a real pleasure talking with you. Hope it's not the last time. Hope we can do this again.
I do too, sir.
And thank you again for all that you've done and all that you continue to do for this country.
Thank you. Appreciate it greatly.
Thank you, sir. Talking again with Pat Rogers here on NRA News Cam and Company from the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Now, coming up next hour, Alicia Ketter from Legacy Defense Systems. I got a chance to meet Alicia for the first time there at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. She's obviously with Legacy Defense Systems, the lead instructor there, but she was in the booth with our friends Ron Bellin and Jeff Axelson of Axelson Tactical, working with them, and Marcus Luttrell on Team Never Quit with their new line of ammunition, which is pretty cool. So it was fantastic getting a chance to meet Alicia in person. And I wanted to have Alicia on to talk about this Every Town for Gun Safety collaboration with Cosmopolitan and the gunsplainers, because apparently I'm a gunsplainer. So we'll talk about self-defense and the need to be able to defend yourself next hour on NRA News Cam and Company. Also, Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum. Coming up on the program next hour. Some legislative news from around the country for you. Montgomery, Alabama, the Alabama Senate, last Thursday passing legislation to prohibit municipalities and counties from putting additional fees and taxes or purchasing requirements on firearms, ammunition, or concealed carry permits. So, you know, we've seen this in Seattle. We've seen this, I think they've tried to do this in Los Angeles, introduced a measure to put an additional tax or a fee on every round of ammunition sold, every firearm sold within the city limits. Senator Phil Williams, Republican from Rainbow City, Alabama, says he's heard anecdotally about county sheriffs in the state trying to require that residents write an essay or show a high school diploma to get a concealed carry permit. He also cited examples from other states where municipalities had raised taxes on firearms and ammunition. He says that's the monkey business we're prohibiting here. Senate Bill 135 says the legislature regulates firearms, quote, including the purchase, sale, transfer, taxation, manufacture, ownership, possession, use, storage, and transportation thereof. The legislature regulates the field of firearms in that regard. Also says a sheriff cannot impose a user fee or any other special fee or any other additional restrictions on the issuance of a concealed carry license. In other words, you can't come up with your own little test there. If you are a issuing authority in the state of Alabama, have to go by the book. When asked about specific occurrences in Alabama, Williams said that he's heard complaints from constituents but did not want to call out particular sheriffs. The bill, according to the Decatur Daily News in Decatur, Alabama, now heads over to the House side. We'll keep our eyes on Senate Bill 135, which, again, is headed over to the House in Alabama. In New Jersey, they are trying once again to put a new smart gun law in place rather than just repeal the old one that the sponsor says doesn't work and admits doesn't work. Rather than just scrap the idea of the legislature trying to mandate in any way, shape, or form smart guns, they are trying to override the current law, which says when a smart gun becomes available for sale somewhere in the United States, that's the only type of firearm that can be sold in the state of New Jersey. Loretta Weinberg, the senator from Teaneck, New Jersey, who was the author of the original legislation back in 99, again, acknowledges that the bill has problems. But she says she's come up with a better law. This new law would require gun stores to carry firearms. You could sell other firearms, but you would be required to carry smart guns for sale. You got to stock them in the store. You can't special order them for a customer who would want them. You have to actually, you know, spend your money on this product that may or may not sell, because the state of New Jersey is going to tell you you have to. NorthJersey.com says the technology has not yet been fully developed, despite, by the way, state funding in New Jersey for well over a decade. Weinberg's bill says that smart guns must be offered 3 years after they enter the market and after being vetted by the state attorney general's office. North Jersey says, NorthJersey.com says, state law requires gun shops to sell smart guns exclusively once the technology is developed, but that law is so strong, gun lobbyists have opposed it fiercely and have prevented smart guns from entering the market. That's an actual statement in a news story. Yeah. Gun lobbyists have opposed that New Jersey smart gun law so fiercely that they've prevented smart guns from entering the market, even though two paragraphs earlier, the same reporter says the technology has not yet been fully developed. Huh. How does that work? Weinberg says the law must be watered down in order to reap its benefits. Who is the reporter here? Salvador Rizzo. I might have to email Mr. Rizzo and ask how these two assertions can be in the same news story. That the technology has not yet been fully developed, but man, if those gun lobby people haven't stopped these guns from appearing on store shelves already. He says Governor Christie did not take action on an identical bill that passed the legislature in January, and he criticized it while he was seeking the Republican presidential nomination, calling it an intrusion into private businesses. How dare Chris Christie call a mandate from the state that a federally licensed firearms retailer must carry a product that currently does not exist. How dare he characterize that as an intrusion into private business? The new bill Salvador Rizzo reports at NorthJersey.com, is pending in the state assembly. Well, we will keep our eyes on this. This would be a veto override attempt. Salvador Rizzo didn't say that in his news story. He's the State House Bureau reporter for the Bergen Record, I think. Huh. Anyway, since Governor Christie did veto this legislation and they're bringing it back, this is a veto override attempt. So if it passes with a veto-proof majority, passed out of the state Senate 21-13, heading over to the assembly, then the law would go into effect over the veto of Chris Christie. I wonder if you have to have a civics test before you report from the State House for some of these media outlets here. Anyway, hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, is straight ahead. More of the day's top Second Amendment news and information from all around the country. Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum with a Nanny State update. And Alicia Ketter from Legacy Defense Systems, firearms instructor, talking about Everytown, Cosmopolitan, and gunsplaining. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this.
I'm speaking with Vicki Callmaker. Vicki, you do so much. Women's Shooting Academy, 1 Million United, Safety Academy. Where do you want to start? Should we start with Women's Shooting Academy?
Absolutely. Let's start with Shooting
Academy. All right. Welcome to NRA News. What's it all about?
The Women's Shooting Academy really came to be, I thought I was just going to teach one class, right? I thought I was just going to teach women how to shoot a gun. And over the last 7 or 8 years, it's just really evolved into something that I could have never imagined. And I've trained thousands of women. And I'm just all about the art of self-preservation.
What is that? Tell me what you mean when you say the art of self-preservation.
You know, I want women to realize that they're worth protecting, their family is worth protecting, and obviously, you know, if we're going to go gun, that is the equalizer. I'd like to see every woman carrying a gun. But at the same time, I realize that a gun is not for every woman. And so it's really taking her on a journey, a personal journey, about her personal safety and getting her to realize that she can own it, she can embrace it, she can fight for it, and she can lose it.
Wow. So how do you do that at Women's Shooting Academy?
Well, our most popular class is called Introduction to Handguns. And what I do with the students is they show up, they spend about 5 or 6 hours with me in the classroom. They learn how to load and unload. They learn everything there is to know about a firearm. And part of that is teaching them the lingo so that when they end up at the gun counter, they don't sound like an idiot. And teaching them the proper way to stand, to hold the gun, really focusing on the fundamentals. Then I take them to the range, and I provide the guns, the targets, the ammunition, and they shoot 5 calibers. They shoot both revolvers and semi-automatics. And after an 8-hour day, they're ready to go to the gun counter, and they can do that alone. They can buy their first handgun by themselves. And then, you know, if they want to come back and take some additional training, absolutely. If they want to get their concealed carry permit, we can do that. They want to learn about shotguns for home defense, we can do that. I'm really excited because I'm starting to see that women want to shoot the big guns. They want to shoot the ARs. They want to shoot this fun stuff. And when they realize it's not as complicated as they thought,
right,
they're in.
There you go. Speaking with Vicki Callmaker, so let's talk about 1 Million United. What is that?
So 1 Million United actually started out to be very political. And it was my answer back to Mr. Bloomberg several years ago. Don't tell us we cannot unite. So hence 1 Million United.
Right.
But over the last year and a half, it's evolved. And what I decided to do with 1 Million United was to turn it into a 501c3 nonprofit. Because I believe that there's women across this entire country who need to hear what I have to say. And I want to offer that to them 100% no charge. I see myself on a large platform teaching safety seminars and really uniting women. And so 1 Million United will be 100% donor funded. And, you know, I got to learn how to raise money. I don't know how to raise money, but I need to raise money. And so that will allow me to just broaden my services. You know, I've got my for-profit companies. Let's do something that will benefit every woman across the country.
All right, almost out of time. How can we get more information about everything you're up to?
Go to VickiCallmaker.com, and from there you can find One Man United, the Women's Shooting Academy, and everything else I do.
Vicki Callmaker, thanks for what you're doing. You're doing so much, and thanks for being here on NRA News. Stay in touch with us. How about
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program, Alicia Ketter of Legacy Defense Systems, Julie Gunlock, the Independent Women's Forum. Coming up about an hour from now, we will have the Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcore Defense, also our Deal of the Day, and our Good Guy of the Day. A little bit more legislative news to get to here before we... turn our attention to some of the cultural issues surrounding our right to keep and bear arms. Tomorrow, February 17th, in the Show Me State of Missouri, the Senate Transportation, Infrastructure, and Public Safety Committee is going to hear Senate Bill 691. This is an anti-gun bill. This is one of those lost or stolen measures that started a few years ago in Pennsylvania. The Brady campaign pushing this. They tried to take it to the state legislature. The state legislature said, nah, we're not really interested in this. Prosecutors said, yeah, we don't really need this law here. If this is designed to cut down on straw purchasers, you're going about it the wrong way. How about we toughen the penalties for engaging in a straw purchase? And that's what the legislature in Pennsylvania did. Brady campaign didn't like that. So they got several dozen communities around the state of Pennsylvania to pass their own lost or stolen gun legislation, which says, to effect, if you are the victim of a crime, if you're the victim of a burglary and your firearms are stolen, you have to report those firearms, all of them, a complete and full accounting, within 24, 48 hours in Missouri. This bill says 72 hours. And if you don't, if you realize a week later or 2 weeks later that you missed a firearm from your collection, that was reported, that was stolen. You're a criminal at that point. You're going to be penalized. You've gone from being the victim of a crime to being a criminal. Yeah. Now you start to see why prosecutors said in Pennsylvania, we don't really need this. We don't really want this. They've got better things to do than prosecute burglary victims for making a mistake. So this bill has been introduced in the Show Me State of Missouri by State Senator Jamila Nasheed. It is 691, again, mandates that gun owners report a firearm to local law enforcement or a sheriff within 72 hours of discovering the loss or theft, or they will face a penalty. The bill scheduled again in the Senate Transportation, Infrastructure, and Public Safety Committee tomorrow. So if you're a Missouri gun owner, make sure that your state senator has heard from you on this. Now, we're also looking at news out of California. We're going to be talking with Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto next hour about last night's Grammys, Barack Obama tweeting out his love for Kendrick Lamar, who apparently has no love for our judicial system, given the cover of his most recent release. Almost dated myself by calling it an album there. But also in California, you know, Gavin Newsom, who's running for governor there, is trying to get on the ballot a big gun control referendum. You would think that California might have all of the gun control laws that it could possibly have on the book, short of outright bans on gun ownership. But you would be wrong. The L.A. Times says, and by the way, there are going to be, apparently, if you're a California resident, there are going to be a ton of referendum issues that will be on the ballot in November. Everything from, the L.A. Times says, raising the minimum wage to fully legalized marijuana, new taxes on tobacco, extended taxes on wealthy Californians. How about raising taxes? That's what it would do, raising taxes on wealthy Californians. And issues ranging from gun control to new rules on legislative procedures and disclosure for government lobbying. LA Times reports that spending on these measures could run to the tune of $500 million this year. LA Times quotes a Politico, Gail Kaufman, a veteran Democratic campaign consultant, who says, quote, I've never seen it like this. In other words, never seen it so close to Election Day when so many of these ballot initiatives are still viable to actually end up on the ballot in November. LA Times says independent contractors who circulate initiative petitions have withstood rainy weather and storefront bans on signature gathering. As a result, some consultants believe that campaigns will be paying as much as $6 per voter signature by the middle of March. Wow. So they say it means a long and expensive campaign season, replete with thousands of television ads, mailers, and digital messages, is just around the corner. And in California, again, one of the big fights will be on gun control. Now, the measures that Gavin Newsom is really pushing here. Here's a piece from back in November by the LA Times. On gun control, Newsom seems to be following Bloomberg's strategic lead. So we kind of have an idea what these proposals are going to look like, right? Expanded background checks, quote unquote, you know, universal background checks, and stolen gun reporting requirements. Oh, we just talked about that a couple of minutes ago, didn't we? In Missouri. They lost or stolen legislation. LA Times reported back in November, campaign finance records show that every town for gun safety last year provided more than $4 million to a successful $11 million campaign in Washington state that the Times says widened background checks on gun buyers. No, it criminalized the private sale or transfer of a firearm is what it did. If you transfer or sell that firearm from your collection without going through an FFL and paying for that background check, you're a criminal. LA Times says similar measures proposed this year in Nevada suggest that there'll be more big spending on this issue. And in California, in particular, every town representatives declined to discuss with the LA Times whether the organization intends to become involved in the proposed California initiative. Neither would Newsom or his political advisors talk about how deeply he plans to tap the Bloomberg vein if his measure is cleared to circulate petitions to place it on California's November 2016 ballot. But Newsom does acknowledge that he met with Bloomberg. He used his Twitter account to thank Bloomberg for seeing him a week after announcing his gun control initiatives. Meanwhile, there's a story out of Connecticut suggesting that the gun control groups are eyeing a Bloomberg presidential run as their plan B, which kind of raises the question, what was plan A? Presumably all in for Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders. But why go to plan B? Why go to plan Bloomberg now? Connecticut Post says there was a glaring omission in the snap analysis of who the big losers were in last week's presidential primaries in New Hampshire. It's a movement synonymous with Connecticut, the Connecticut Post writes. Gun control. Gun control was a big loser in the New Hampshire primary. Runaway victories by Trump and Bernie Sanders, the populist U.S. senator from Vermont, have unsettled groups such as Connecticut Against Gun Violence and the Newtown Action Alliance, the latter formed a response to the 2012 Sandy Hook Elementary School shootings. Neither candidate stands up to their litmus test like Clinton, the gun control groups say, citing Sanders' voting record and Trump's macho rhetoric. Ron Pincaro, executive director of Connecticut Against Gun Violence, says, however, of course, Bloomberg's been very helpful on our issue, and we would see his possible candidacy as a good thing. Now, the Connecticut Post says Clinton's top messengers in Connecticut, including Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, downplayed the scenario of Bloomberg running for president on a gun control agenda. Blumenthal said, "I have deep admiration for Michael Bloomberg's eloquent advocacy on this issue, but I think Hillary Clinton has demonstrated over many years her equal passion and fervor." He says, "My hope is that no candidate owns this issue, and that they are all on the right side with the same passion and commitment, and it becomes a defining issue between the Democrat and Republican candidates, not among the candidates on our side." He just wants everybody to be anti-gun. By the way, what's happened to the homicide rate in Hartford, Connecticut, since the passage of the gun control laws in 2013? Any guesses? Way up, actually. Up in 2014, up in 2015 as well. So they've been on the increase for the past couple of years, almost as if these gun control measures are not effective at reducing violent crime or increasing public safety. But Senator Richard Blumenthal is still hoping that this will be the big issue in 2016. He also said it is premature to discuss a third-party candidacy by Michael Bloomberg, which seems kind of funny since Bloomberg himself has started discussing a third-party candidacy by Bloomberg. But Blumenthal says there's a lot of speculation in political circles about a potential Bloomberg candidacy if the Clinton campaign runs into real trouble. Everyone seems to accept that his decision won't be made until there are additional primaries. Again, really astute analysis from the senator from Connecticut, given that Bloomberg himself has said these things. Connecticut Post says Clinton's gun control allies, who include Governor Daniel Malloy, have criticized Sanders for his vote against the Brady Bill when he was a member of the House. Another strike against Sanders, they say, was his support of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which shields firearm companies from liability claims when one of their guns is used in a crime. Sanders' campaign did not respond to a request for comment, but his supporters took great exception to the criticism that the self-described Democratic Socialist is soft on gun violence. Sal Accioni, a Sanders volunteer and a Democratic town committee member from Westport, says he has an F rating with the NRA. I thought it was a D-minus, but maybe it's an F. David Yaloff, political science department head of the University of Connecticut, says that this is one of the very few areas, gun control, where Hillary Clinton can get to the left of Bernie Sanders, and says, quote, "It definitely helps her to harp on it." Really? Did it help in New Hampshire, where she got clobbered? 22.4 percentage points, right? The Connecticut Post says, tapping into voter anger towards the political establishment, Wall Street wage disparity, and the high cost of health care and college tuition, as what Bernie Sanders did. Gun control factored much more prominently, they say, in Clinton's pitch to voters in the Granite State. And again, she got defeated by 22.4 percentage points. David Yaloff, the political science department head at the University of Connecticut, said, "Oh, no, this helps Hillary to harp on gun control." It hasn't yet. I'm kind of astounded that he would say that. I mean, not really. Because the conventional wisdom, you're not going to hear a supporter of gun control say it makes no sense for Hillary Clinton to play up gun control. Right? Just not likely to happen. Yaloff also told the Connecticut Post, as long as the House is controlled by the Republicans, it's clear that gun control is not going to be high on the president's agenda. New presidents don't like to come in and lose. That'll keep it muted, and that'll keep it from being the great litmus test for Bernie Sanders. As long as the House is controlled by the Republicans, Yaloff appears to say, all right, it's gonna be controlled by the Republicans even after November. It's clear that gun control is not going to be high on the president's agenda. But wait a second. That makes no sense. because Hillary Clinton says it is going to be higher on her agenda. Hillary Clinton has said if Congress won't pass gun control, she'll do whatever she wants to do through executive orders. New presidents, he says, don't like to come in and lose. Hillary Clinton's already said if she's president, it won't be a loss in Congress because she won't go to Congress. She'll pass her executive orders. Universal background checks, I believe, is what she wants to do with executive orders, right? That'll keep it muted, Yaloff says, and that'll keep it from being the great litmus test for Bernie Sanders. So the same guy who says that Hillary Clinton's doing a great thing by running on gun control also says it's not going to be the litmus test for Bernie Sanders. Huh. Again, that doesn't really sound like very astute analysis to me, but what do I know? I happen to think it's a bad idea to run as the pro-gun control candidate in a country in which we have an explicit individual right to keep and bear arms. We also have a growing number of Americans who are exercising that right to keep and bear arms. And we have even more Americans, it seems, by the day who are becoming aware of their rights. Now, when we come back after a quick timeout, Alicia Ketter with Legacy Defense Systems, she sees those Americans who are becoming aware of their rights and wanting to exercise them all the time as a firearms instructor for Legacy Defense Systems. We'll talk with Alicia about the new Every Town for Gun Safety Cosmopolitan campaign to try to turn single women away from being gun owners and from dating gun owners as well. Stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Philip Hosnoot with Salted Earth. Philip, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing well. How about you?
All right. So tell us, what is Salted Earth? What do you guys do?
So Salted Earth is a technology startup. We're based out of Arizona right now. Been in business about a year, focused primarily on dry fire training, bringing targets to market to help people train anywhere and in any environment.
So when you say technology startup, what kind of stuff? You've got a product here you're going to show us. Is it mainly oriented towards the firearms industry, or is it all sorts of stuff?
We're basically exclusively in the firearm industry right now.
Okay. And what is it that you do? What kind of product?
So this is the first product that we're launching in a lineup. It's part of the Atlas series, which stands for Adaptive Training Laser System. It's a whole system of targets.
Wait, and so we get to see the first product you're doing.
This is the first product that we're launching, debuted here at the SHOT Show. It's a reactive dry fire laser training target. It's the kind of one of the many sizes we'll be coming out with. Has an 8x8 array of LEDs and allows you to basically simulate most of the types of trainings you'd normally do at the live fire range.
So how does that work?
So we have it works with any red, green, or infrared laser. This is a next-level training training pistol. It'll work with anything, including Crimson Trace. Works with flashlights as well. So you can basically configure it through our mobile app to run any standardized training that you normally would.
Very cool. So it gives you an opportunity, a way to train without having to actually be on the range.
Right, exactly.
Very safe, very portable, very anything. So it's the company's called Salted Earth. What's that product?
That's the Atlas 8.
The Atlas 8, and so does it come sort of together as a kit, or is that just a separate part of it?
Right now it's a separate part. We're looking at potential partnerships down the road.
How can you get more information about your company and about the Atlas 8?
You can go to thesaltedearth.com. We have a lot of information up there, a lot of videos of it in action, how to use it, that kind of thing.
Phil with Salted Earth, thank you for this great new product. Thanks for showing it here on NRA News, and thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm speaking with Chris Midgett with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website. But it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So so how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just publish it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the firearms guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in the Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guide. First click, you click on hangers. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel. Let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRE News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum coming up in studio with a nanny state update. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Legacy Defense Systems, Alicia Ketter is with us. Alicia, how you doing today?
I'm great, Cam. How are you?
You know, I am good. I appreciate you coming on the program. It was fantastic to get a chance to actually meet you in person up in Harrisburg. And you were one of the first people I thought of today when I logged on to Twitter. I was blissfully off of Twitter for many hours last night. I log on this morning and I see Every Town for Gun Safety is calling me a gun splainer here. Here's their tweet. He blames victims and survivors for not having a gun to defend themselves. Meet the gun splainer. And here's the quote. This is in apparently the March issue of Cosmopolitan magazine. If you're the victim of a violent crime, the burden of stopping that assault is not going to be on the person committing that crime. Not at that moment in time. The burden of stopping that assault is on the victim. It is on the victim. That burden, Alicia, that unwanted responsibility, reluctantly accepted, is on the person who is being attacked at that moment. Because you can't expect the attacker to come to their senses or develop a moral compass. And you can't count on law enforcement to be right around the corner to stop that attack, right?
Right. You're absolutely right. And, you know, last time I was on your show, I told you what a sheriff's deputy told me. And that was, he told me, I can't be there when you need me there. You need to carry a gun to protect yourself because I will only be there after the fact to clean up the mess and fill out the report. And so what choice does that leave us? We have to protect ourselves. And that's the unfortunate reality that we live in.
So you don't see it as gunsplaining or victim blaming when women come to you and say, I'd like you to teach me to be a better shooter.
Not at all. I think it's the wisest decision they've ever made. And honestly, you know, it makes me really proud to see women come in and take responsibility for their own safety, to get some training. But all too often we get them after they've become a victim, after they've been abused or they have a stalker or they have, you know, some domestic abuse or something like that. But, you know, we also get those women who recognize that there isn't going to be a cop around the corner when they need them and they need to be proactive about their safety.
You know, and it's interesting that you talk about the number of women who come to you after they've been the victim of a crime. And certainly being the victim of a crime gives you a whole new perspective, right? I mean, it can't help but give you a whole new perspective. But yet, it's interesting. I don't think this collaboration between Every Town for Gun Safety and Cosmopolitan Magazine, I don't think they talked to any crime victims who decided, I want to become a gun owner. I don't think they talked with Kimberly Corbin. Did they reach out to you, ask you for any help in contacting a woman like this?
No, absolutely not.
Huh.
And, you know, it's interesting because I was reading an article in Marie Claire about Amanda Collins. And again, we talked about Amanda Collins last time. And Amanda was a victim. She was raped.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a concealed carry permit, but she was prohibited from carrying the night that she was brutally raped at gunpoint. And Amanda says, over and over in her mind. She's replayed the event, and if she had had her gun, she is convinced that she could have defended herself against that attacker. So, you know, they're not talking to the victims. They're not talking to the women who have experienced these things. But I see them every single day.
You know, and again, it seems to me, I know that Cosmopolitan partnered up with Everytown for gun safety. This is not going to be an objective look at gun ownership. But I wish that they would have. I wish that they would have said, all right, you know what, Everytown, we're happy to partner with you. We agree with you, but we're also going to reach out to the other side. We're also going to talk to, you know, people who like you, Alicia, are training and educating women each and every day. And we're going to find out why women are interested in becoming gun owners, why the Everytown message doesn't resonate with them. That's not what we got, apparently.
Not at all. And what we got was really, you know, I read that article as well this morning, and what we got was them saying women should stay away from men who have guns because they're potentially more violent, and that if there's a gun around, that gun's going to be used against them, rather than saying women need to learn to make better choices in the partners that they're in, that we need to strengthen the existing laws that are on the books. We need to enforce them. You know, they didn't really take any approach that could solve problems. They're looking at the gun as the real issue rather than the violence as an issue. And as you and I both know, violence is agnostic of a tool. It's a matter of a person making a choice to be violent, and they will select whatever tool they choose, whether it be a gun, a baseball bat, a knife, whatever. It's not about a gun. It's about the behavior.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, their checklist basically consisted of is the guy you're dating or the guy you're thinking about dating a gun owner? If so, don't, right?
Yep.
As opposed to does this guy have a short temper? Does he get easily upset and irrationally upset over little things? Does he have to denigrate you as opposed to treating you like a human being, right? I mean, there are a lot of signs here that someone is capable of emotional and physical abuse. Gun ownership, I don't think, is really a predictor of that.
No, not at all. And in my experience, it's been the opposite of that. In my experience, legal, law-abiding gun owners are some of the most responsible and respectful people you'll ever encounter in your life. Now, that's a generalization, and of course, there's always bad seeds, and you know, in every walk of life. But as a general rule, I have not seen that to be the case in increasing the risk of violence or bad behavior being linked to gun ownership. In fact, the opposite.
Talking again with Alicia Ketter from Legacy Defense Systems. And so, Alicia, is there growing interest? Is this just, you know, hype from the gun lobby, or are you really seeing more women who are interested in becoming gun owners?
Absolutely. You know, our classes are selling out in multiple states. We actually travel to multiple states to teach, and we have waiting lists that are months deep that are all women. And we hear everything from, you know, they want to be prepared for ISIS and the threat that they're seeing come here to their front door, to, you know, hey, I want to be able to protect my children. And women are finally standing up and saying, I can't just rely on somebody else to protect me, because the world isn't like that anymore. I can't just assume that my husband's going to take care of me, or that there's going to be a cop there, and I need to take responsibility for that. And that's even beyond the gun. I mean, we get women who are not ready to shoot and are not ready to carry a gun. And honestly, if you're not ready to carry a gun, I don't want you to carry a gun. But I do want you to be prepared. So they come in for self-defense classes. They come in for all kinds of other training as well. But they recognize their vulnerabilities, and they recognize their need.
You know, and I'm really glad that you mentioned that, because this this quote that Everytown has highlighted, in which I'm apparently gunsplaining, I don't actually say the word gun, and I certainly don't use the word blame.
Right.
You know, but you're absolutely right. You know, whether or not, frankly, this is why I think the position that Everytown and Cosmopolitan has taken is so odd, because basically what they're saying is self-defense, no matter what form it takes, is somehow victim blaming. And I don't see how they get to that point. I mean, if your advice is, listen, don't own a gun, carry around a tongue depressor so you can vomit on your attacker, that's still a form of self-defense. I happen to don't think it's the most appropriate and effective form of self-defense, right. But you are still advocating for a form of self-defense.
Yeah, absolutely. And really the tone was that there is no hope for you, and that you really should not go out and seek any training, and you should not invest in any skills that will improve your chances or survival. That thought process really baffles me.
I got to say, it baffles me as well, Alicia. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. It is great talking to you. If folks are interested, I know you say that you travel. If folks are interested in maybe trying to, you know, put together a class and bring you to town, how do they do it?
They can give us a call at the Women's Shooting Academy. They can check us out online. That's the best way to get a hold of us. Put a group together, and we'll come to you. And additionally, Cam, if any woman or man is out there with a signed protection order, we will train you for free.
Really? That
Absolutely.
Is fantastic. Do you mind me asking, how often do you get those requests?
Fairly often, actually. Our local police departments are very familiar with us, and they refer people to us. So when they encounter a woman who's in danger and needs a protection order, they walk her through that process, and then they refer her, and sometimes him, to us to get training.
You get referred by law enforcement?
Absolutely.
They don't say, listen, this piece of paper is like a suit of armor. It'll protect you. You've got your order of protection. You don't need anything else. They don't say that?
No, shocking.
Huh. That's well, good for them, Alicia, and good for you all for doing that. That is fantastic. Again, I really appreciate you coming on the program. Love having you on the show. Hope we can do this again soon.
Absolutely.
All right. You have a great day, Alicia. We'll talk to you again soon. Alicia Ketter from Legacy Defense Systems. I wonder why law enforcement would refer individuals who have had to take out an order of protection to a firearms instructor. Why, it's almost as if, yeah, cop-splaining, Cameron says, it's almost as if these law enforcement officers know that this order of protection, if it's violated, that individual who violated that order of protection might end up in court, might even face maybe a year in jail for violating that order of protection after the fact, right? After the fact. And let's hope and pray that that's the only charge that he'll face, violating that order of protection. But you can't help but think about women like Carol Bowne, right, in New Jersey, who had taken out an order of protection. But because Carol lived in New Jersey, law enforcement officers couldn't, you know, refer her to Alicia Ketter. And the women at the Women's Shooting Academy, because Carol had been waiting for more than a month for her permission slip to exercise her Second Amendment rights and buy a firearm to keep in her home, not even to carry around, which Carol could have used because she was murdered in her driveway by an ex who had that order of protection taken out against him. And that was a charge that he faced. But, you know, the year in jail for violating that order of protection, it's nothing compared to the sentence that he received for murdering Carol Bowne. So you might as well throw that charge out. Huh. Well, we come back after a quick timeout. Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum going to be with us with a Nanny State update. Stick around. We do have much more. NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bill Romanelli with the NSSF Project Child Safe. Bill, welcome to NRA News.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Hey, thanks for being here. And what a great program, the Project Child Safe program. I absolutely love it. Tell folks, what is it?
Yeah, for those who aren't familiar with it, this is the firearms industry's safety program. It was launched in 1999 as Project Home Safe initially, and then it evolved into Project Child Safe. And it really operates along two central fronts. One is it's all about firearm safety education, primarily focusing on responsible storage of firearms when they're not in use. And then hand in hand with that, the other facet of this, and kind of the centerpiece of the program, is we give away free gun locks to police departments all across the country to hand out in their communities. And so far, we've given away 37 million of those locks.
37 million.
Yeah, it's been a phenomenally successful program, and it is something that the firearms community can be very proud of.
Wow, that's amazing. So tell, how did this program get started and why?
Well, primarily it got started because it was an opportunity for the industry to step up and say, you know, we don't want to see firearms accidents happen. There's, you know, even today, unfortunately, too many stories of children finding loaded guns in the home and an accident resulting from that. And so this industry stepped up. There was a brainstorm of somebody at NSSF to come up with this program to basically let's teach people what they need to know about proper firearm safety and expel some of the myths like, you know, a hidden gun is not a safe gun, for example. And at the same time, let's take away some of the barriers to safe storage by making these locks available for free.
And Bill, you're with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. People don't know that the NSSF is the industry, the shooting industry's association.
That's a trade association.
Yeah, trade association.
Industry, huh?
So you have done this, you know, working in concert with the, you know, all the different gun manufacturers. But NSSF has really taken a leadership role as this program has grown. Tell us over the years, how has it grown and changed?
Sure. Well, we were very, very big program in the 2000s. We were getting a lot of federal funding through the Department of Justice to do the program. And that's where we had a lot of our biggest successes and where we, you know, were giving away most of the locks. Then in 2008, the grant terms expired and they weren't renewed. And so the NSSF on its own continued to fund the program for the next several years. And I am happy to say that for 2016, some of that federal funding has now been renewed.
Oh, good.
To the tune of about $2 million, which, you know, as we say, every $2 puts another lock in someone's hands. And so that will provide a lot of money for both making more locks available in communities as well as getting more educational resources out there.
And Bill, one of the things we all talk about is, as you mentioned, is safety is paramount. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're at home, you're on the range, that's like, you know, the first order of business when it comes to, you know, the firearm, you know, using a firearm, whether you're hunting or shooting or at the range or whatever. So in some of the time we left, you know, what are some of the most egregious kind of safety violations you guys are aware of?
Well, you know, it's the funny thing. It's like when you look at the rules of firearm safety, number one, they're not rocket science. And number two, they really haven't changed since the firearm was invented. It's pointing in a safe direction, you know, keep it stored safely, things like that. And my personal opinion is I think that's why we have some of the accidents we do is because the rules have been out there so long and they're so simple that we get a little bit complacent.
Yeah, and maybe take them for granted, right?
Exactly.
Which, when it comes to a firearm, you never want to take it for granted. So
that's right.
It's Bill Romanelli. It's the NSSF Project Child Safe. I love it. Bill, how can people get more information about Project Child Safe, about the National Shooting Sports Foundation? What do they need to do?
Sure. The easiest thing, of course, is going to go onto our website, which is www.projectchildsafe.org. We really would love people to, as individuals, sign up as supporters of the program. Also for organizations out there, retailers, shooting ranges, people in the conservation community. You know, we want as much help as we can get getting this word out. We don't rely on ourselves alone. We want to basically have essentially a team of messengers out there helping us get this message out there to the firearms-only community. And if I may, you know, it's something that I've noticed is that the firearms-owning community, the firearm community as a whole, you know, they're a very proud community. You know, they do not like being villainized or demonized.
Right.
And then, you know, they in fact focus on ethical hunting. They focus on responsible gun ownership. They're looking for something to be for and something that they can rally around. And this is a program that they can do that with.
That's awesome. All right, Bill, we got about 20, 30 seconds left. Once again, how can we get more information about Project Child Safe?
Sure. Go to www.projectchildsafe.org. If you're looking for safety resources, just click on our safety tab. Cool. Our entire library of safety resources is available there.
Beautiful. Bill Romanelli, the NSSF Project Child Safe, thanks for what you do. Thanks for the National Shooting Sports Foundation for what they do. And thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company. Top of the hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well. Plus, Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto. Bethany Bora, who breaking a little news there for the John Cardillo show, finding out that at a Hillary Clinton campaign event in Florida yesterday, students were bussed in. Yeah, apparently a little field trip to a campaign rally. Now the school district says this shouldn't have happened. Again, after the fact. Anybody going to face, I don't know, in-school suspension for it? Any sort of punishment for the individuals who bussed these students to the campaign rally, even though they didn't particularly want to go? Doubtful. But we'll talk about it with Bethany coming up in hour three. Right now, though, want to talk to our friend Julie Gunlock of the Independent Women's Forum, who joined us in studio early today for a Nanny State update. Take a look and a listen. Julie Gunlock, it's good to see you in studio. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And thank you to your husband for watching the kids, because your kids, like my kids, still out of school today, right?
Out of school, yes. But the husband is out of work. Well, he's not out of work, but he stayed home. So, yes, I could come. That sounded bad. I could come into the studio.
Well, good. I'm glad, and thank you, Mr. Gunlock, for watching the kids for a couple of minutes. Now, you've been very busy. You always are, but a number of columns that you've had over the past week or so, including this piece in the New York Post, Sorry, but poor kids can still eat healthy. Tell me about this. So the argument is that if you're poor, that all of your good food choices are gone away. You're stuck with nothing but fast food, cheeseburgers, and junk food, right?
Yeah. So that's one of the narratives that we see trotted out all the time by food writers. They say, the poor have only one choice for food, and that's fast food, and that's why we have these skyrocketing obesity rates. And another reason, and that's not true. They Share Our Strength, which is an anti-hunger organization, has done some studies on how poor people eat. And it turns out they only eat out once a week. Mostly they eat at home. They eat simple meals at home. They make very simple foods that are fairly nutritious. So that really isn't restaurant food isn't really the cause. And I've said on this show many times, there isn't really one reason why people have gotten heavier. There is a variety of reasons. It's a very complicated issue. So I'd read a piece in The Atlantic, and this author was talking about childhood obesity and why it's hard to get kids to eat healthy food. And I agree, sometimes it is really difficult to get kids to eat healthy. But he was saying that on average, you need to present a food, like sort of child psychiatrists or child psychologists have looked at this, and child development specialists have looked at this, and a child has to eat a food about 10 to 12 times, or see a food 10 to 12 times before they eat it. And so he was saying, so that's sort of the new excuse that, poorer people can't present a food 12 times, and just keep presenting it to their kids. So that was the point of the article, was I don't think that's true. I think that it used to be that we told kids, you're not getting up from the table unless you eat your food. I mean, yes, it's really nice if we can present some food to a child 10 or 12 times and just say, oh, I hope you eat it. But I mean, there's this whole universe of parents who don't sit around and who aren't patient with that. And I mean, I'm not. I say, you have to eat 4 bites of that or you're not getting up from the table. So I sort of attacked that narrative coming out of sort of the food nannies and food writers out there.
And it's interesting because, as you point out in your piece, parenting is still the key here, right?
Yeah.
I have friends, they shall remain nameless, but their child, for a good long time, like the kid was almost 10 years old, the only thing that he would eat, I'm not kidding you, Julie, applesauce and chicken nuggets. That was it. That was what this kid would eat. And I would ask myself, wasn't good enough friends to actually ask my friends, how did you let it get to this point? But that was always the question. How did you let it get there? I mean, at some point, have the no thank you bite of carrots and peas, right?
Yeah.
You take that bite, you eat it. As you say, you don't get up from the table, until you've had your dinner, or at least a couple of bites here. It's mind boggling to me. And I have to tell you, you've met my wife. So when my wife was a single mom in Camden, New Jersey, she was poor. And there's no, bones about it. She was poor. But she cooked, putting herself through college, and then she was working, had to rely on public transportation. It took a long time to get home, but she cooked for her kids. And as you say, they were simple meals. It wasn't like, you know, she was cooking a Julia Child French dinner every night. But she was cooking real food as opposed to, I don't want to say, maybe, you know, taking the easy way out and, you know, getting a frozen pizza or getting a pizza from 7-Eleven or a burrito. She actually took the time to cook these simple meals. And I think that does make a difference.
Yeah, what we don't talk about so often, you see out of Washington, they blame fast food. They blamed soda. They blamed yucky and non-nutritious school lunches. They blamed, convenience stores and gas stations. They blamed food deserts. They blamed just about everything. But what you don't hear out of policymakers in Washington is parenting is to blame in large part, or at least partially, for this. You don't hear anyone talking about parenting. In my piece, I said, we can kind of, scratch our heads and navel gaze about how many times we present to food and is it enough? And, should we ban things or put taxes on things? But, what we really need to consider is how parenting has changed in this country, I think everywhere, but how permissive people are now. I think there is a universe of parents who don't present carrots and peas 10 times and patiently watch their child pass it over or throw it on the ground or throw it in the garbage. I think there's an awful lot of parents that say, you are going to be punished if you don't eat at least 4 bites of that. Now, my children are miserable when I make them eat something on their plate that they don't want to eat. They cry, they're upset, they're angry, they give me faces. They act tortured, but they eat them because they want to get up and play. They don't want to sit at the table all night. Yep. And so that is,
and here's the thing,
that's
Julie,
a tactic that some people might want to try.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Have you ever run across an adult who said, worst thing about my childhood, my parents would make me eat, bites of food that I didn't want to eat. I've never forgiven them for that. I don't have a good relationship. Don't ask me about my mom and dad because we don't talk anymore because they used to make me eat meatloaf and I didn't like meatloaf. I had to have liver and onions and I didn't like liver and onions. I've never met that person.
I bet if I lived in certain parts of the country, maybe Berkeley, you might run into those types.
Okay, I'm not saying that they're not out there. But I've never met that person. And so I think, again, as parents, we have that desire, and I think it's largely a cultural desire. At least we get the cultural okay to make sure that every day is your kid's best day ever.
Yeah.
And that's not what being a parent is all about. You can't live in the short term as a parent. You can't. It is hard sometimes. Yes, you don't want to see your kids cry. Yes, you don't want to have a tantrum at the dinner table every night. Yes, it gets old. But they grow out of it too.
Yeah, I honestly
don't enable this.
I think parents on. I mean, this sounds horrible to say, but I think parents need to care less. They need to care less about their children's opinions on certain things. When did it start being normal to give a crap what your kid thinks about dinner? I mean, when did that start being a thing? Like, I care what my kids think about the meal I've just put in front of them. I don't care. Eat it and go away. I wish there was actually less caring about children and their opinions on what's being put in front of them. Michelle Obama, you want to talk about a great role model on this? Michelle Obama. Now write it down. I'm about to praise the first lady here, but I give her a lot of credit for some of the, when she does talk about parenting, she talks about her own mother, and I actually put this in this piece about how Marian Robinson, Michelle Obama says she didn't care about my opinion on what was put in front of me. I was expected to eat it. She says, dessert wasn't an every night thing. My dad sometimes got seconds, but not always. Her mother was tough on this stuff, and that's what we need. We need better parenting, tougher parenting. I actually put in my piece, try yelling at them. I mean, I know that that's, that's a big no-no nowadays, but I do this and it works. Occasionally I yell at my kids. I say, eat your food. So I just wish there was, there just seems to be so much you know, what can we do? Oh, we present, maybe if we present it 20 times, you know, maybe if we ask their opinion a few more times. I just think some old fashioned parenting is probably warranted in this area. Kids have never liked vegetables. You know, they've always had trouble with healthy food. This is nothing new. I don't think we need really complicated solutions to this problem.
Keep it simple. And you channeled Kurt Schlichter there as well.
Oh, I did.
I like that. All right.
That's a compliment.
You really, truly did. Absolutely. All right. So we've only got a couple minutes left here. As I mentioned, there's a lot of stuff that you've been writing about. We just got through with Valentine's Day. So we'll talk about your piece at Acculturated on compulsory of Valentine's, right?
Right.
Be my compulsory Valentine. So your kids come home from school. They've got their list, and the teachers say that, okay, you don't have to participate in Valentine's Day, but if you do participate in Valentine's Day, everyone will be your Valentine.
Everyone.
Everyone.
Even the kid who's, you know.
We don't want anybody's hurt feelings.
Even the kid who's bullying you. I love you. Yeah, it's
right?
Look, I get it. We don't want anyone
be
to feel.
Be my tormentor.
I love you for torment. Do it more. I know this is all part of this. We don't want kids to feel left out and we want everyone to be friends, but I put in there, it's like Potemkin's Valentine Village. I mean, it's a lie. And so I don't mind these things when they're younger, kindergarten, first grade, but I have a third grader and he has definite opinions about certain kids. And kids have opinions about him. I mean, it's not just that my child doesn't like certain kids. It's that there are kids that genuinely, I mean, and that's okay. You know, we don't all have to be friends. And so I just find it interesting that we should be applauding kids for sort of, developing opinions and becoming individuals and realizing that they have to get along with kids, but they may not. You know, they may not be best friends with everyone. And this is sort of natural. This is how the real world works. And then, you know, every year the teachers say, put aside all those natural feelings and tell everybody in the class you love them. So I wrote this piece at Acculturated. You know, you've mentioned before the comments on Acculturated pieces are really, really great. I love reading the comments, particularly on my pieces. And there's some really funny, comments on my piece about what people's experiences are in this area. So again, you know, I don't want to say that, you know, you have to write an actual, I don't want my kid to write an honest note like, I actually don't like you and I find you annoying at lunch. But I just find the whole practice to be a bit bizarre, particularly for the older kids.
Yeah, well, and as you point out, with your kids, no candy allowed either, so you can only have the
yeah.
cheesy card, right? You couldn't even have like the stupid little sugar hearts that say, be mine.
Yeah,
or,
but I love some parents totally rebelled. Some parents rebelled. My kids did come home from candy and I say, fight the power, people. I love those parents who sent their kids to school with, you know, contraband. That was great. There were a couple suckers and a couple kisses that managed to get into my kids' Valentine. And the teachers didn't you know, trash them. So I applaud everyone for that.
You need a column called Julie Gunlock, Rebel Parent.
Right.
That needs to be a thing, Julie.
I have a new column called Freak Out Friday at the American Spectator, where I take on like the latest freak out. It's once a week. It's on American Spectator, and it's hashtag Freak Out Friday on Twitter. So check that out. That's kind of good. I get to be a little cranky
awesome. And
have fun with that.
Fantastic. All right, listen, enjoy the rest of your week. And we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Julie Gunlock from the Independent Women's Forum joining us here on NRA News Cam & Company. Coming up in Hour 3, we have our Hero of the Day, sponsored by AdGore Defense, our Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day as well, plus a Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto, Bethany Bora, conservative activist, and I may have seen for the first time, maybe it is the first time, a Vox story that didn't make me roll my eyes. How about this? German Lopez, 6 proven policies for reducing crime and violence without gun control. Now, I have to say, when I started reading, I did roll my eyes a little bit because he writes, America's debate over gun violence now follows a very familiar routine. One side calls for gun control measures to reduce access to firearms and violence. Another side says no. That would violate the Second Amendment. Maybe some legislation gets proposed, but in the end, little or nothing seems to happen. So what else can America do to reduce gun violence and crime more broadly? I have a problem with that question. The article itself talking about ways we actually can reduce violent crime that
don't involve failed attempts at gun control. I think it's good to talk about these things because, again, they're actually effective. Where I have the issue is this kind of baked into the cake notion that the gun control policies that are offered by anti-gun activists actually reduce crime and make us safer. Right? I mean, again, look at the homicide rate in Hartford, Connecticut, after the passage of very restrictive gun control laws in 2013. Look at the homicide rate in Baltimore, Maryland, after the passage of the Maryland Firearm Safety Act in 2013. Look at the very violent weekend that we just had in Chicago, a city with very restrictive gun control laws, a city that had a handgun ban in place until 6 years ago and has been dragged kicking and screaming towards the recognition of the right to keep and bear arms while still trying to make it as difficult as possible to be a legal gun owner. I dispute the assertion that this is even something that what else can America do? No, what can we do? Because gun control doesn't make us any safer. These gun bans, these laws that are aimed at the law-abiding gun owners, the legal gun owners in the country, aimed at narrowing their ability to be a legal gun owner in the country, why would we think that they would impact the violent crime rate? They don't touch, these laws don't touch the people committing violent crimes. Shockingly enough, that's the common denominator in all of these things that German Lopez covers, the nonpartisan ways to reduce crime and gun violence without going after the guns themselves. That's the common denominator. Stricter alcohol policies was one. A higher alcohol tax, reducing the number of alcohol outlets, revoking alcohol offenders' right to drink. Hotspot policing was another subject. It says police can obviously play a huge role in reducing crime. He had to, by the way, start out with a bit of an apology for talking about policing efforts as something effective in reducing violent crime, because I guess that's the Vox audience. Anyway, we'll talk more about this piece at Vox next hour. Christian Toto, Bethany Bora, hero, deal, good guy of the day. It's all coming up, so stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, right after this.
I'm here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum. Ashley, good to see you again, and thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah, we don't have any guns today.
I know, that's okay. We're going to talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man, the Cody Firearms Museum is actually, it's one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library, and there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms, and they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how there's such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from 1425. Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company. And so they collected international firearms. They collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, with 1425. And so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West. And so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to tell, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contests or anything?
Yeah, it's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You wanna loan it over here?
Loan
that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But you know what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some. I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had, right now, they're displaying Eisenhower's, one of Eisenhower's guns, and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we. And I was like, we did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have, so stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum. And it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster. And, you know, first off, I mean, you know the 61's great, and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it. And then it also, we knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to, like, a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861, and his name was Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in the American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one, a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it, and then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it, just doesn't get much better.
Awesome. How can you get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. On the program this hour, Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense, Deal of the Day, Good Guy of the Day, Christian Toto of Hollywood in Toto, talking about the Grammys last night, and Bethany Boer, conservative activist, breaking a little news down in Florida, finding out that some students at a Hillary Clinton campaign rally had been bussed in. Mm-hmm. And now the school district says, sorry, we probably shouldn't have done that. Let's get to our Hero of the Day, Deal of the Day, and our Good Guy of the Day. As I mentioned, our Hero of the Day, sponsored by Adcor Defense. We actually have two stories for you today. First one from WREG in Memphis, Tennessee, Channel 3. They report a man is in the hospital after police said he tried breaking into a woman's Highland Heights home and she shot him. A line of officers parked outside of a house on Powell Street Monday night after receiving a call from a woman who lives there saying that she had shot a man trying to break into her home. A 14-year-old neighbor who didn't want to be identified says, I looked out the window. I saw him kicking at the window, kicking at the door. He says he was playing video games next door when he heard the drama unfold. He said, when I stepped out the front door, I saw him kicking at her car, punching at her window. Teenager said the woman and man were in and out of a relationship and had been fighting for weeks. The man, she started shooting at him as he tried to gain entry to the home, ran off, later found driving around with a gunshot wound. He was rushed to the hospital. Police say they'll question him. As for the teen, WREG says he's just glad his neighbor is okay. She said, I look at her as a sister, and it made me feel like I hope nothing is going to happen because I don't want to lose anyone else. That woman in Memphis, Tennessee, again, defending herself from a man trying to break in, our Hero of the Day. We'll keep our eyes on that story out of Memphis, Tennessee, and if there are any additional updates, we will bring them to you. Our second Hero of the Day, from Las Vegas, Nevada, News 3 in Las Vegas. They say a South Las Vegas homeowner ended up shooting a man trying to get through the family doggy door. Witnesses say the man was on a home invasion rampage before he was shot in the face. The attempted home invasion occurred in a residential neighborhood near Cactus Avenue and Las Vegas Boulevard. Nicole Slocken says the intruder banged on her door before he was shot. She remembers getting a call from a neighbor about the suspect hitting her door. Slocken said, she said, are you okay? Are you okay? Someone's trying to kick down your door. I said, oh my gosh. It was after midnight on Friday. She said the man was trying to break in the door, kicking it, trying to break it down. Couldn't get through her front door. So he went to a home next to Nicole Slocken. Witnesses say the man was armed with a 12-inch knife, tried getting through the doggy door. Homeowner again ended up shooting the man in the face. Locken says, quote, I think it was very brave. I'm glad he did it. It made me feel better that he's armed. Oh, really, Nicole? Are you sure about it? I think Cosmopolitan and every town for gun safety would like to have a word with you. Nope, she says, I think it was very brave. I'm glad he did it. It made me feel better that he's armed. Made me feel better that my neighbor was able to defend himself against this guy armed with a knife who tried to break down my front door and then was coming through the doggy door. Home invader taken to the hospital. News 3 in Las Vegas says he's now recovered and is in jail. Neighbors say the man tried forcefully entering at least three homes on the street. The brash break-in, News 3 says, has people in the South Las Vegas community unnerved. They quote Caroline Galenza. She's 77. She says, it was really, really scary. I kept on thinking I can't eat the following day. Nicole Slotkin says she believes the outcome would have been different if her neighbor had not called her with a heads up and if her next door neighbor did not shoot the suspect. Slotkin says, quote, the detective told me the neighbor very well could have saved our lives. The detective told me the neighbor very well could have saved our lives. Well, there you go. That unnamed neighbor in South Las Vegas, your other hero of the day. Our deal of the day comes from KUTV. A very dangerous man in Utah released from jail just weeks before he crashed into a patrol vehicle. Channel 2 in Salt Lake City reporting that a man known for years to police, said to always have, quote, been a danger, was able to get out of jail weeks before it's alleged he led officers on a weekend chase, crashed into a patrol car, and ultimately fled into the night. They say, like other recent instances of men who have been sprung from lockup only to commit serious crimes, the case of Christopher John McMillan may prompt questions over judicial decision-making and a penal system that seems increasingly tilted towards rehabilitation rather than incarceration. Lieutenant Dalen Taylor of the West Valley City Police says McMillan was wanted for a probation violation, said he's well known to us, he's a very dangerous individual, we've known him for years. McMillan was arrested last November in Salt Lake City for crimes in Park City in the Mill Creek area of Salt Lake County. In the Park City crime, prosecutors said he broke into a business and stole $100,000 worth of fur coats. In the second instance, he was accused of fighting his own brother, pistol whipping him, and shooting his brother in the foot. Court records said McMillan appeared before a judge in Summit County and requested a modification of his bail. The judge said, okay, we'll make this a bondable offense, but you got to have an ankle monitor on as a condition of your release. Well, that work out. In Salt Lake County, bail was set at $250,000 for his charges of aggravated assault, discharge of a firearm, and being a restricted person in possession of a gun. In other words, convicted felon. But even that $250,000 bond or bail wasn't a problem. A bail bondsman covered McMillan's bail. McMillan is now accused of ditching his ankle monitor. Yeah. Channel 2 in Salt Lake City says they've been told by a former Utah parole officer that a good pair of scissors can cut the ankle device. And once a wire is snipped, a signal will go to companies that are under contract to provide electronic monitoring. Okay. What happens then? Another document signed by Summit County's chief prosecutor there in Utah said, quote, a court document put the date that McMillan, quote, forcibly removed his ankle monitor as February the 6th. February the 8th, he failed to show up for a preliminary hearing on the theft charges. According to the court document prepared by prosecutors, the court was notified by the electronic monitoring company of the ankle monitor breach on February the 9th, 3 days later. And then what happened? Nothing. I mean, police are looking for him, but it's not like an all-point bulletin went out. It's not like officers were told, drop what you're doing. We got to find this guy. That's not what happens. This guy was found
sort of out of happenstance. Attempted traffic stop. Then there was a chase, crash into a patrol car, and then the guy took off again. Another document signed by Summit County's chief prosecutor said McMillan has a, quote, lengthy criminal history, including convictions for theft and aggravated assault. That chief prosecutor there in Summit County said the state fears that if McMillan is released on standard bail, he will abscond and commit new crimes. And sure enough, it's kind of what happened. Now, police say that Mr. McMillan, when he's caught, will likely face new charges. Aggravated assault on a police officer and felony evading. Oh, and the police added that he is, quote, violent and he does carry a weapon. And he's back out on the streets. Today's deal of the day, Christopher John McMillan, there in the state of Utah. Our good guy of the day comes from WKOW in Wisconsin. It's a great story. A police officer in Madison, Wisconsin, helped return a Purple Heart to a veteran who had lost his medal. 69-year-old Craig Hampton received his Purple Heart while serving in Vietnam. He was with Company B, 1st Battalion, 7th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Cavalry Division. Received the Purple Heart in 1966 when he stepped on a landmine. Mr. Hampton is still in a wheelchair today. His medal was found in a backpack that was abandoned outside of City Hall in Madison, Wisconsin, back in early December. And Officer Michael Brennan worked with the nonprofit Purple Hearts Reunited, and he was able to determine that the medal indeed belonged to Craig Hampton. Officer Brennan said, quote, it was just very important for me as a veteran and a Gold Star father to return a Purple Heart in person and present it in a ceremonial manner rather than just giving it to someone to return to the police station or mailing it in the mail. He said, I wanted to make sure that it was done in a very formal manner and a respectful manner, as we did. Officer Michael Brennan knows very well the sacrifices that the members of our military make, that their families make. Officer Brennan's son, Joshua, was killed in 2007 while fighting in Afghanistan. Staff Sergeant Salvatore Ginta of the U.S. Army received the Medal of Honor for trying to save Joshua Brennan during that attack. And again, this police officer, Madison Police Officer Michael Brennan, took it upon himself to fly to California to present that Medal of Honor back to Craig Hampton. And you can understand why Officer Brennan said it was important to me as a veteran and a Gold Star father to return that Purple Heart in person. And again, to present it in a ceremonial manner, not just dropping it off in the mail, not just mailing to the police department saying, all right, Mr. Hampton, you got it. Just go down to the police department. You can pick it up. Michael Brennan said he was very appreciative of Craig Hampton, and it was very rewarding. He said he just couldn't be happier that he was able to receive that Purple Heart back. Madison, Wisconsin police officer, Michael Brennan. Not really a case of in the right place at the right time and stepping up to do the right thing. I suppose he was the officer who got the call about the backpack. But this wasn't a happenstance moment that Officer Brennan's instincts kicked in and he rushed into a building or saved someone from a fiery car wreck. This is a different type of instinct, the instinct of a father, the instinct of a veteran, the instinct of a individual who knows, again, the sacrifices that Craig Hampton has made for this country, and who wanted to not just present that Purple Heart back to Craig Hampton, he wanted to honor Craig Hampton. And so thank you, Officer Bennett, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto is going to join us on the program. But before we take a break, I want to go back to this Vox article. Six ways that we can reduce violent crime without gun control, which is good because gun control doesn't really reduce violent crime. Anyway, I said that all of these measures that Vox talks about are actually focused on the violent offender. That's not necessarily the case. For instance, stricter alcohol policies. That's kind of on everybody, right? So they say a higher alcohol tax. A 2010 review of the research in the American Journal of Public Health came out with strong findings. Quote, our results suggest that doubling the alcohol tax would reduce alcohol-related mortality by an average of 35%, traffic crash deaths by 11%, sexually transmitted disease by 6%, violence by 2%, and crime by 1.4%. So you double the tax on people who drink, and you'll see perhaps a 1.4% reduction in crime. Maybe. That's just what the American Journal of Public Health's research suggests. Let's set that aside and see if there's things we can do that would be better. They say also we're reducing the number of alcohol outlets through, for example, stricter licensing in an area can limit problematic drinking and its dangers. But this 2009 review published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine also found that going too far can have negative results by, for example, causing more car crashes as people take long drives to outlets and possibly drink before returning home. So maybe we should set that aside, too. Revoking alcohol offenders' right to drink. South Dakota's 24/7 sobriety program effectively revokes people's right to drink if a court deems it necessary after an alcohol-related test. Studies from the RAND Corporation have linked the program to drops in mortality, DUI arrests, and domestic violence arrests. Uh-huh. I'm thinking, again, that might be kind of hard to police. Let's set that aside. Second way to reduce violent crime, according to Vox, hotspot policing. They quote David Kennedy, who says, in many cities, a very small subset of places, down to the street and the block level, drive most of the crime. So deploying police intelligently in these specific areas can have a big impact on fighting crime and violence. Now, this goes hand in hand with the third suggestion there from Vox, focused deterrence policing. Just as David Kennedy says, look, a lot of you can have a city that, let's say, has a pretty high crime rate. Chicago, for example. Chicago has a horrifically high violent crime rate. But not every neighborhood in Chicago has a horrifically high violent crime rate. There are some neighborhoods in Chicago who are pretty darn safe, right? But there are some neighborhoods in Chicago that aren't. It kind of makes sense. Focus on the most dangerous locations. Have an increased police presence there. Violent crime might go down. Goes hand in hand with focused deterrence policing, which, as Vox explains, it hones in on specific problems in a community such as drug dealing, generally violent behavior, gangs, or gun violence. It then focuses on the individuals and the groups who drive most of that activity, particularly those with criminal records and those involved in gang activity. In other words, focus on the people who are disproportionately responsible for violent crime in their communities. David Kennedy says the national annual homicide rate now is between 4 and 5 per 100,000. But if you're in one of those street networks, your homicide rate can easily be 3,000 per 100,000. 3,000. So why not focus on those individuals rather than focusing on the people? By the way, I would say that the those in those street networks where their homicide rate is as high as 3,000 per 100,000, they're one of the big reasons why our homicide rate is between 4 and 5 per 100,000. It'd be lower if you didn't have the high-risk offenders out there. So we've talked about this, again, on NRA News Cam and Company quite a bit. Raise the age or grade for dropping out of school, they say, is the fourth way that you could reduce crime and violence, keep kids in school longer. You know, again, in theory, sounds great. But you also have to think there's a reason why in many cities there is such a problem with kids dropping out of school. And if you say, well, you just can't, we're just going to keep you there longer.
what's that really going to do unless you're actually able to educate these kids? Again, this to me seems like a little bit of a Band-Aid solution. But they say that older kids, this is a study in North Carolina, older kids who were older than their classmates because of, you know, where their birthday fell in the calendar year, more likely to drop out, more likely to commit a felony offense by the age 19. One of these study's authors told the Vox reporter that his findings strongly suggest keeping kids in school will reduce their crime rates. They said in North Carolina, for instance, the dropout age is 16. They could raise the dropout age to 18 or older. Phil Cook, one of the authors there of the study, said if North Carolina raised its age to 18, there would be some seniors in particular who would cross that threshold who would be legally entitled to drop out. But the prospect would look different than it does at age 16. They would be closer to the finish line, so presumably it would not be as enticing. Okay. It's also, again, it's going to be hard to do. And we don't really have any idea of how well it would reduce violent crime. Not saying it's a bad idea, just that it's not, you know, again, a perfect solution either. Behavioral intervention programs is another idea. Vox article talks specifically about youth guidance as becoming a man program from the University of Chicago Crime Lab. Targets youth who are at risk of getting into violent encounters, perhaps because of the neighborhood they live in or what school they go to. Program then uses once-a-week interventions based on cognitive behavioral principles to teach youth how to react in encounters that can turn violent. Vox says it works. Randomized controlled trials by the crime lab found a reduced violent crime arrest by 30 to 50% during the time of the intervention. Well, that's good. What happens when the interventions stop, I wonder? But again, you're focusing on those who are most likely to commit violent crimes or most likely to be the victims of violent crimes. It seems to me that if that's where your focus is, you're likely to see better results in reducing violent crime. The sixth example they gave of a policy that could reduce violent crime instead of trying to go the gun control route, which I don't think Vox will admit this, but I'll say it. It doesn't really work to go the gun control route. They say one of the more unexpected ideas from policy experts, clean up and repair blighted buildings. A 2015 study from Brannas, part of the Urban Health Lab, and other researchers found that fixing up abandoned and vacant buildings in Philadelphia had led to significant drops in overall crimes, total assaults, gun assaults, and nuisance crimes. There was no evidence that crime shifted to other areas, although there were signs that drug dealing, drug possession, and property crimes went up around remediated buildings. Still, they say net gains overall. Brannas said it makes the space appear cared for and suddenly criminal activity doesn't want to happen there. Also, the neighbors get more invested in the space and look after it, more of an informal policing mechanism. Which does seem to make sense, right? If a community is invested in their community, they are less likely to tolerate as a community the violent crime that goes on in their midst. Now, again, this isn't as easy as it sounds either. A lot of big cities with violent crime problems don't have a lot of money to spend on fixing or tearing down blighted buildings. Right? This really isn't a big priority. But again, you look at what's being suggested. Find those areas where violent crime is most likely to take place. Find those individuals who are most likely to commit violent crimes and target the spaces and the people who are driving violent crime in your community, and you will see violent crime drop. Why this article from Vox sounds like it could come from a show here on NRA News Cam and Company, because that's what we say all the time. Focus on the people who are committing the violent crimes. Focus on those violent areas. Don't cast as wide a net as you can over law-abiding legal gun owners and think that you're going to see a reduction in violent crime. Why would you expect that? Target your policies, and you'll see real results.
How about that? From Vox. Now, is this a gun splainer or a Vox splainer, Cameron? I can't, because it's about guns and how there are things you can do, you know, that don't involve guns that could actually make people safer. But it's also from Vox. So is this a Vox gun splainer?
Here's an Uber splainer.
Ah, there you go. All right, well, whatever. It's a weird, you know, just another sign. It's a weird time when I found a Vox story I like. All right, when we come back, Christian Toto from Hollywood and Toto will join us. Bethany Bower later in the hour as well. Stick around. We have more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball, I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, you know, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Speaking with Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. Dan, welcome to NRA News. Tell us, what is Hire Our Heroes?
Yeah, so Hire Our Heroes is a nonprofit organization that basically helps transitioning veterans to position themselves for employment as they get out of the service.
Why'd you start this, Dan?
I served in the Marine Corps Reserves, and after 8 years, I got out thinking I had this great skill set. I was a satellite communications specialist, and shortly thereafter, long story short, there was really no opportunity for me to really find employment or anybody to help me find employment. So I felt like I was on an island by myself, and I thought if I couldn't be the only veteran going through this, that there was probably a need for a greater reach. And lo and behold, I gathered a few other veterans, and we formed Hire Our Heroes, basically founded by veterans for veterans.
That is great. So what's the reaction been to Hire Our Heroes?
You know, it's been phenomenal. It's one of those things, be careful what you wish for. The response has been overwhelming at times, but it has been nothing short of great and rewarding at the same time. There's nothing but opportunity for us to help veterans. And believe it or not, there's a lot of nonprofits out there, and these veterans still have a tough time really finding the right one that's going to bring them down the path to success as they transition out.
Dan Cap-
we feel like we've got a pretty cool tool set to do that.
Awesome. Dan Caporelli with Hire Our Heroes. How can folks get more information about the great work you're doing and your great organization?
Visit us on the web at hireourheroes.org, and they can fill out information on whether or not they're interested in transitioning, reaching for somebody to reach out for them to connect, as well as some of our other services and that we offer.
Dan Caporelli, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Bethany Bora
join us in just a little bit. But right now, we want to welcome to the program our friend Christian Toto from HollywoodInToto.com. Christian, how you doing today?
I'm good. How you doing?
I am. I'm really good. I completely forgot that the Grammys were on last night, and I probably wouldn't have watched anyway because we were watching a movie with the kids. But I did see that President Obama tweeted out congratulatory messages to Kendrick Lamar. Recently, he said that Lamar's song, How Much a Dollar Cost, was his favorite song of 2015. And he gave a shout out to Kendrick Lamar and all the artists of the Grammys working to build a brighter future. Which is weird because Victor Davis Hanson was writing about the cover of Lamar's latest To Pimp a Butterfly. And I have to say, Christian, the description doesn't sound like Kendrick Lamar is really interested in building a brighter future. It shows a crowd of young African-American men massed in front of the White House in celebratory fashion, Victor Davis Hanson says. All are gripping champagne bottles and $100 bills. In front of them lies the corpse of a white judge with two X's drawn over his closed eyes.
Can't you feel the love and healing?
I believe maybe there is a cover of Can You Feel the Love Tonight on that album. I mean, you know, so Victor Davis Hanson says, why wouldn't the president's advisors at least have advised him that such a gratuitous White House sanction might be incongruous with a visual message of racial hatred? Obama's met with Kendrick Lamar. I actually met with Kendrick Lamar a few hours before the State of the Union address. Clearly, you know, this is something that the president is happy to talk about and happy to advance Kendrick Lamar's career here.
Yeah, there's someone I follow on Twitter who always says that one of the things I love about the age of Obama is the racial healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, listen, Obama is certainly right to connect his message with Kendrick Lamar's because I think there's in a way they're very simpatico, unfortunately. But I think this sort of victimization is part and parcel of what we've seen over the last 7 years. And the fact that Kendrick Lamar, a very talented, I'm sure hardworking young man, who as at the peak of his success and at the pinnacle of fame at the Grammys, comes on stage in chains, I don't quite get that. I mean, I kind of feel like a society that elevates someone of color like him to that kind of lofty pedestal, kind of thinking we're accepting and kind of loving him and kind of saying, hey, we want to hear more of your music. And so I think there's a real conflict there for me.
You know, and it's interesting, Christian, because I think that part of this is, I mean, certainly Kendrick Lamar is not the first celebrity out there who, as you say, receives a lot of public adulation, including high profile adulation, who I don't want to say defines himself by being persecuted, but has a certain narrative of being persecuted. In fact, I would say that's fairly common among celebrities, right? A lot of celebrities feel like no matter how popular they might be, no matter how many people go to see their movies, they are a tool of the system here, and that somehow, despite their millions and their popularity, that they too are victims somehow of society.
You know, if you talk to Alec Baldwin, I'm sure he'd say the exact same thing. They won't leave me alone. They pick at me. They misquote me. They call me terrible names. And I wish it wasn't the case. Of course, he's a multimillionaire and adored by millions of people for his acting work. So, yeah, there is sort of a conflict there. You know, what was interesting is that between this performance and the Beyonce performance at the Super Bowl, there's all this talk about sort of black pride and black empowerment. That's fine. But if Kendrick Lamar went on stage last night and did kind of a Bill Cosby-esque speech about education, about kind of taking care of your family, about kind of self-empowerment and self-improvement, I think the same media people who are just tripping over themselves to applaud him would be denigrating him.
You know, it would be interesting to see what the reaction to that would be, because I honestly don't know. I don't know what the reaction would have been. I think I could certainly see that scenario where you know, if you don't say the approved message, that all of a sudden now Hollywood and the left will turn on you. And I think that we actually, you know, we do see that. It'll be interesting. You know, one of the other stories that we're talking about today is the frontman for Eagles of Death Metal, Jesse Hughes, giving a very emotional interview to Fringe Television, talking about how he doesn't think France's gun control laws saved any lives during the terror attacks, how he carries a gun. He said, you know, he wishes we lived in a world without guns, but until we do, he wants everybody to have a gun if they want one, to be able to protect themselves. And, you know, I wonder what the reaction from Hollywood, from TMZ, from other sites will be here. Obviously, there was a lot of love shown to Eagles of Death Metal and their fans in the aftermath of the terror attack. But now that Jesse Hughes, he hasn't, you know, quote unquote, learned his lesson, right? He's still talking about gun ownership. He's still saying that he's an NRA member. Will that love and respect go out the window?
I think it'll be diminished. I think certainly the fact that even those who disagree with his message will basically understand that he just went through an ordeal. And I think sort of the social justice warrior knives won't be out for him like it would in other situations. But yeah, no, I think that will sort of cut into his image as far as the media is concerned, as far as the pop culture overlords are concerned. And, you know, it depends how often he says it. If he keeps talking about it, then maybe the criticism may get more direct.
Maybe so. Talking with Christian Toto of Hollywood and Toto.com. So, Christian, as far as the Grammys go, you know, the other aspect of this Kendrick Lamar love fest from the president is, you know, and I know this is something that we've talked about before, and it's still this amazing contradiction to me that there are times when the entertainment industry says, listen, we are nothing more than entertainers. Whatever it is, our medium, if it's music or movies or TV, it's simple entertainment. Nobody's going to get any influence. Nobody's going to get any sort of message from our material unless we are now playing the artiste card. And now we are to be taken seriously. And now our music, our movies, our TV are supposed to influence people and have an impact on people emotionally or viscerally. And it strikes me that we still see celebrities trying to have it both ways, right?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think it might have been my old colleague John Nolte from Breitbart who quoted, who kind of came up with the clown nose on, clown nose off for Jon Stewart, where he'd make a lot of political comments, and if you attacked him or critiqued him or said, hey, wait a minute, he'd say, oh, I'm just a comedian. And I think that celebrities do that as well. They kind of want to say it's just an act, it's just fun, but then they also want to send a serious message. So I don't think they can have it both ways, and they're going to try. But listen, it's the way the culture works these days. These things have an influence, and these things matter, and well, I think we'll see more of it, frankly.
All right, Christian, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It is always a pleasure, and make sure that you at home visit HollywoodandToto.com. And Christian, look forward to talking again very soon.
Oh, many thanks.
You bet. When we come back, Bethany Bowra, conservative activist, will join us. Also a new piece at New York Magazine. Man, all these pro-Bloomberg pieces, they just seem to be running in the New York-based media. It's weird. It's weird. New York Magazine, Jonathan Chait, why Michael Bloomberg could run for president and win. Notice it's not like Texas Monthly with this article. Right? It's New York Magazine, because that's the demographic, I suppose. All right, stick around. We'll be right back with more NRA News Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Speaking with Sean Diem with GDS Global Dynamics Security. Sean, welcome to NRA News. You are doing some very interesting and novel stuff with dog training that's got some incredibly far-reaching applications with terrorism, counterterrorism, military, law enforcement. Tell us, what's it all about? What are you guys doing?
Well, we have developed a new and revolutionary behavioral science method or model and a training method that is the next generation of canine detection, of dogs finding stuff with their nose. And the implications of this are tremendous for counterterrorism, for finding bad guys, finding bomb factories, finding terrorists in a crowd. And the sensitivity of these dogs is exponentially greater than conventionally trained dogs that we're used to seeing now. For example, our dogs can consistently find 3 rounds of AK-47 ammunition on the second story of a building from 4 or 5 buildings away, off the leash, go to the building, go up the stairs, and put their nose exactly where those 3 rounds of AK-47 ammunition are. What does that mean? That means that we can find the Karachi brothers in Paris. We can find, before they strike, we can find the Sarnarak brothers in Boston before the Boston bombing. We can find the Paris attackers before they attack. Because this becomes an offensive, proactive asset, and it changes everything.
So, Sean, explain, how did you get where you are now with this new approach?
I started about 25 years ago, and realized that the behavioral science model, the way people thought of and saw dogs and animals, and the way they believed that their brains worked, I knew that had to be wrong because it didn't work in getting them to do things, to train them. So I started in about 1990 to create a new behavioral science model and training method. And I worked extensively with biting dogs, extremely dangerous animals that if you get it wrong, people get hurt. And in that intense environment, I was able to have tremendous control over the dogs, tremendous performance, and then I moved into working with wolves extensively. And those wolves taught me a great deal about behavior because I could see the raw, unchanged, evolved behavior of wolves. I actually lived in a house that had several wolves in the house. I don't recommend it, but it was a great experience. That enabled me to build the foundation. And then from that foundation, I was able to construct a training method and approach that works for any working application. Then in 2011, I went to Bomb Dog School, and within a few days, I realized that the method they were using was minimally effective. And I've been told by many conventional trainers that they believe their dogs, when odor is available, will find it about 20% of the time. And that means 80% of the time they may be walking past it. So, and I also saw on the wall of the training room there a picture of a military bomb dog handler, and I asked about him, and he had his legs blown off with the dog right next to him. Mm. Well, that told me that this cannot be working well if the dog is not reacting in a strong way. Well, we put about 4 years into completely reinventing the method and starting from scratch, figuring out what stimulates dogs. How do we get them to indicate faster, more accurately? Our dogs will consistently indicate down to the size of a quarter where the source material is. That means explosive ordnance disposal people can find exactly where that box without having to dismantle an entire wall in order to find something that's 6 inches in diameter. Our dogs narrow it down to the size of a quarter. I knew that they needed the speed. They needed the reliability. Our dogs never give a false response. They indicate almost 100% of the time. It is possible that odor is not available, and they wouldn't find it because it's not emitting enough molecules for them to find. They're more versatile, and that's how we got there, was by rebuilding the method and looking at it in a primal, evolved way.
How can folks get more information about this new approach?
They should go to globaldynamicsecurity.com, globaldynamicsecurity.com. Shoot us an email. We are now looking for teaming partners, security companies, government agencies that are looking to implement a super effective counterterrorism and security asset. We're ready to work with them at globaldynamicsecurity.com.
Sean, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you, John.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by our friends at Nosler. I want to welcome to the program Bethany Bora, conservative activist, joining us for her weekly appearance. Bethany, how you doing?
Hi, Cam. I'm great. How are you?
I am good. So you made Drudge, huh?
I did.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So what's the story here, Bethany?
Well, I went to a Hillary Clinton event yesterday in Palm Beach County that she didn't show up for because she had fundraisers instead. But Bill Clinton was there. So I was standing out on the corner at the rally and a school bus pulled in. And I thought that was a little bit odd because A, yesterday was President's Day, so schools were closed. And B, a school bus coming into a partisan rally like that isn't really normal. So I looked and a bus full of students in band uniforms with their instruments got off the bus. And the bus left, and then a few minutes later came back with another busload of kids. And long story short, they played their music at the rally. There was cheerleaders. They were all wearing their, like, uniforms at the rally. And then come to find out, the school district actually responded this morning with a comment and said that should not have happened. It won't happen again, and they're looking into it because the district policy doesn't allow students to perform at political events like that.
Huh. I wonder how it could be that if this was against district policy, it actually happened. Bethany? I mean, that seems so weird.
I wonder.
Yeah, because, you know, it's weird. I mean, like, you never see teachers say, I'm going to teach something that's not really in the curriculum. I think we need more emphasis on the Constitution, for instance, right? And never happens that way. But somehow, somewhere, a teacher and I suppose a bus driver, the transportation department must have gotten involved here. This wasn't just like one person, right?
Right.
Huh.
It assumes that the principal approved this because it was a high school in Riviera Beach that brought kids over. So it's assumed that the principal had to approve this because it's a legal holiday. So someone higher up than just a teacher would have to approve the band kids actually going to the event.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're waiting to hear back on that. But the event overall was fun. I enjoyed myself.
Did you really?
I really did. They're all very, very nice people. 99% of them are old enough to be my grandparents.
This is at the Hillary Clinton rally.
Yes.
Well, you know, Bethany, we've seen Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries. He's capturing the vast, vast majority of the 18 to 29-year-old vote. And in fact, I think he's capturing the vast majority of people under the age of 50 or so on the Democratic side.
Yeah, it wasn't surprising. It really wasn't. And it was interesting to see, because you always hear about it, and you hear about young people really having a dislike for her.
Yeah.
But it was neat to actually go to the rally and see the kinds of people that show up for her events. Because it was an official Hillary event, even though she wasn't there. So it was interesting to see that it's really not just numbers on paper. It really is in person. The only people who go to these rallies, in large part, are elderly people.
Now, did you talk with folks about why they are supporting Hillary Clinton?
I talked to a couple. I did, and they really didn't have any concrete answers. They just loved her for some reason. I think it was a lot of nostalgia. They loved her when she was first lady, so they it just carries over, and they want her to go back to the White House because they loved her so much in the 90s. A couple of people just want a woman president, so that was their logic behind it, but there was really no concrete answer of she's done this while in office and that's why I support her. It was kind of just I don't know, this is what I feel like today.
Interesting, because the New York Times has a piece, I guess this is going to be in tomorrow's paper, Hillary Clinton's candidacy reveals generational schism among women. Exactly what you're talking about here. They went to Pennsylvania State University a few days after Bernie Sanders trounced Hillary Clinton in the New Hampshire Democratic primary. They talked with Renee Tillman, Melanie Suarez, and Cameron Sandage, who were all sophomores, and they were asked if they consider themselves feminists. Renee Tillman said, I couldn't even tell you what a feminist is. She said that she and her friends note the generation or that the nation has already had a black president. She's African American. The New York Times says they see themselves in a post-gender world. Cameron Sandage, who's also African American, said, quote, I don't find gender that important. So it does seem that there are, again, this is something that Hillary Clinton ran into in New Hampshire, where, again, a lot of young voters really got turned off by the idea that this campaign for Hillary Clinton is about making Hillary Clinton the first female president, not about what Hillary Clinton can do for these young voters who are women.
Right. I think that young voters are a lot smarter than the Democratic Party is giving them credit for. And I think that they were really counting on the fact that young people were just going to want the first female president. So they were counting on that young women vote, that young female vote, to put her in office just because of that. And it's kind of coming back to bite them because those young women are, if they're Democrats, are overwhelmingly supporting Bernie. So it's neat to see how that strategy that seems so impeccable is really, really backfiring on them. Because I only know a couple of young female Hillary supporters. All the rest of them are Bernie supporters.
So I know the last time we talked, you said that a lot of these Bernie supporters, he's the new shiny object, right? He's the not boring candidate.
That's a good way to put it.
Right. Well, he's the not boring candidate, I think is how you put it.
Right.
Are you finding yet, Bethany, Bernie Sanders supporters who are interested in learning about what socialism actually is at all?
Not really.
I was afraid you'd say that.
I don't think that's a conversation that they want to have.
You know, like I said, I was afraid that you would say that because I had some interactions, a couple hundred interactions with Bernie Sanders supporters on Twitter the last weekend, and they keep tweeting this meme from Bernie Sanders' campaign website that says Democratic for the people, socialist by the people. No, I'm sorry, other way around. Democratic by the people, socialist for the people. So if it's by, so democratic socialism, Bethany, it's just by the people, for the people. Everything from the U.S. Postal Service to our military to roads and bridges to Social Security, all of these are socialist programs, and they've been socialist programs from the get-go. Don't you see? You're so stupid, seems to be their argument.
Right.
And
they think that democratic socialism is somehow different from regular socialism.
Yes, absolutely. That it, you know, democratic socialism apparently is Norwegian socialism,
right?
Right? It's not Cuban or Soviet socialism. It's not China. It's not Venezuela.
Right.
Sometimes they'll even talk about just European socialism, which if you look at the, you know, financial condition of the EU right now, I'm not really sure that's something you want to be touting.
Right.
But yeah, I keep waiting for someone to actually say, okay, so this guy's the first guy in U.S. history to run, you know, outside of those who ran on the socialist ticket, as a democratic socialist. I wonder what that really means. It really just seems like, you know, they like that excitement. Maybe they like the promise of free college and free health care, but they don't want to seem to really dig into what it means that Bernie Sanders calls himself a democratic socialist.
Right, and I think that's one of the biggest things for sure with them embracing that democratic socialism is the free idea of free college, because there is so much college debt that's swirling around that they want someone, and they need to see someone really talking about that issue for that person to gain their trust. And I think Bernie is addressing it. A, he's addressing it more than any other candidate is, and B, he's addressing it in a way that obviously is very appealing, because if it says free, then it must be good. But I think that's something that Republicans really need to get to jump on more if they want that youth vote to come over to our side in the general, is you have to address student loan debt and you have to address college affordability, because those are two major issues that directly affect these young voters that they're trying to win over. So I think that's a really big issue that we're kind of dropping the ball on right now that has to be picked up if there's any chance of winning the youth vote in November.
All right. To that end, is there a way you think that conservatives could talk about these issues that would be compelling enough to compete with the idea of free stuff?
Well, the Republican approach to this issue is much more logical than saying anything should be free. So I think if you say that and you just tell them, like, look, nothing in life is free. That's just how it is. And young people know that. They love the idea of free college, but I think deep down they know it's not realistic. So if you present your idea for reforming the system and you say, like, look, here's what I want to do and here's how it will help you, it's something that they will embrace, because it's much more rational and it makes much more sense than just shouting the word free into a void and hoping that something sticks.
But you got to have a real idea.
Right. You have to have some kind of plan. Just don't yell free at me.
All right. Well, listen, Bethany, I appreciate you coming on the program. I will be following along closely to see if you do hear anything back from the school district. And congratulations, by the way. I found out yesterday when I was on John Cardillo's show that you are the new intern for the John Cardillo show. So congratulations.
I am.
It is a truly small world.
It is. Thank you.
Absolutely. Well, listen, we look forward to talking again very soon, and a great job covering the Hillary Clinton rally.
Thank you, sir. Have a good day.
You too. Bethany Boer joining us, conservative activist, college student, intern now for the John Cardillo show down in Florida, and attendee at a Hillary Clinton rally. That was a bit of a that was like a Southern slam there from Bethany. Did you notice that? Did you pick up on that? Oh, they were all so nice. They were old enough to be my grandmother. Right? It's one of those, like, bless your heart statements. She's learning. She's good. All right, we do only have a couple of minutes left here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. The good news is today's only Tuesday, so we've got another fantastic show for you that we are working on tomorrow. We're going to talk with Julie Golub from Team Smith & Wesson. Julie has a piece at her website, juliegolub.com, about the Marie Claire's the Marie Claire piece about gun ownership and women. It's not just Cosmo. What's fascinating is that apparently Marie Claire reached out to Julie Golub, asked her a series of questions. Julie gave them some well-thought-out responses, and Marie Claire didn't run them, any of them. So Julie has printed her interview with Marie Claire. She also has a more on the Marie Claire issue of women and guns. She says that she was disappointed that to illustrate the NRA's efforts to connect with women, the piece hyperlinks to a biased anti-gun article from Slate.com. Every Town for Gun Safety received special thanks for their help with research and sources. So another magazine taking up the issue of women and firearms to advance the gun control position, not to actually really truly examine the issue of why more women, for instance, are becoming gun owners, why more women are becoming concealed carry holders. No, instead, these magazines have a special section on just why that's a bad idea, why you shouldn't be a gun owner if you're a woman, why you shouldn't support concealed carry laws, why you shouldn't support the National Rifle Association. So we'll talk with Julie Golub of Team Smith & Wesson on tomorrow's program. Also, Kimberly Corbin is going to join us. You know, we've talked with Kimberly several times before about her own personal experiences as a survivor of rape and her desire to carry a firearm for self-defense. She's a little annoyed by the gun-splaining that is going on here from Everytown, Cosmopolitan, Marie Claire, trying to tell women that, you know, listen, the right way to think about this is to think that gun ownership is wrong, right? So we'll talk with Kimberly Corbin, also from the Great American Outdoor Show, talking with Ed Fisher from Leek Mountain and Hunting Preserve. You know, we've talked with Ed on the program many times before, but this is such a great organization. So many great nonprofits that we got to meet up in Harrisburg at the Great American Outdoor Show who work with veterans, who work with kids. And Ed and the folks at Leek Preserve have been doing this for years. They have received several NRA grants. They are getting bigger. They are growing. They are getting more space so that they can host more veterans and wounded warriors. It's just truly an incredible story. Look forward to telling you more about that on tomorrow's edition of NRA News Cam & Company. Thanks so much for being a part of this program, and we'll see you here soon with more NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by our friends at Noslin.